Who are in the audience, we have Representative Shumper here already, but if there are any others, well, you're welcome to join us at the table, if so. But this hearing started out because I introduced a bill last session that would turn over the health assessment, or would start a health assessment of pesticides in Minnesota, because right now we don't really assess the health risks or safety of pesticides that are registered here. The Department of Agriculture says they don't do risk assessments, and I don't know that that would be the appropriate place for it in the first place. And so legislation, I dropped it in on how we would have the Commissioner of Health be required to review the health risks of certain pesticides. And as we've been looking at this issue in the last several years, I think there's been a lot of concern about why we deal with pesticides the way we do, and it raises the whole issue in my mind of how sometimes politics interferes with science. And I've seen a couple of cases, in a case a year or two ago I was dealing with in the Environment Committee, where a PCA scientist was fired for some research that was not acceptable to the top of the agency, and I have concerns about similar things happening with this issue. But I'm mainly going to, most of the hearing is going to be presentations by Dr. Tyrone Hayes from University of California, Berkeley, and Paul Watzka, a hydrologist, and Department of Agriculture then. But I'm going to start out just by explaining. I'm not going to move over there unless somebody objects, because I was just going to explain what's in Senate File 2055. I'm not planning to, we can't act on the bill now. I do plan to give the bill a hearing during the next session, but just wanted to explain what it does. And with that, you should have a copy of this in your packets, but all the bill does is require that certain types of pesticides, ones that are either probable carcinogenic pesticides, known carcinogenic ones, endocrine disruptors, or high-potency nervous system toxins, which I believe totals about 50 out of 185 pesticides that are sold in Minnesota. There are more than that that are registered, but apparently about one in four of the ones that are actually sold in Minnesota would fall under that list. It would require the Commissioner of Health to review pesticide registrations of those chemicals to see if there's scientific evidence of increased risk to public health and safety, and the Commissioner of Health would have final authority on whether they would be registered and any restrictions that would be placed on the registration of those pesticides. And the legislation spells out what types of health risk concerns the commissioner is supposed to review in the process of that, and the factors they are supposed to consider in terms of registration determinations. And this would not change what the Agriculture Department does in terms of pesticides. It would simply add some health risk assessment to the process, which is not there now. And that's basically what the bill does. Be happy to take questions on it, but again, we can't act on it now, so I just wanted to introduce the bill, because that spells out where I came into the concern about the issue of how we deal with science in our public agencies these days. And the person who I most wanted to come here for this hearing, Dr. Tyrone Hayes of University of California, Berkeley, has been in Minnesota a number of times in recent years. I first became acquainted with him when he had been invited to speak at the Pollution Control Agency, a keynote address at one of their convention meetings of some sort, and was later disinvited. And I hope, Dr. Hayes, that you'll feel free to tell that story or whatever when you present your research. And with that, I will let you go ahead, and we'll assume, do you want questions after you're done or during the way, or it doesn't matter?
Whatever doesn't matter to me, whatever's best get the information across.
With that, please proceed, and you can introduce yourself and however you want to go ahead.
Okay. We had a little bit of technical difficulties, but I think it's clearing itself up now. My name is Tyrone Hayes. I'm a professor of integrative biology at the University of California at Berkeley. And I have been studying the effects of atrazine primarily on amphibians for the last 10 years. particularly I look at how pesticides might act as endocrine disruptors or cause hormone imbalances in animals when they're exposed. And we might, for the screen, we might have the lights down a bit. It might make things a little more...
We will try and dim the lights at least at that end. This room is not the best room for lighting, but...
Okay. I just want to start by acknowledging and, in fact, disclosing the funding sources for the work that I'm going to talk to you about today that's been going on in my laboratory for about the last 10 years. In particular, I want to disclose that I was initially and have been funded by Novartis, Syngenta, and the group EcoRisk. These are the manufacturers and their consultants of the chemical atrazine, which is primarily what I'll talk to you about today. I've also had federal funding as well as private funding, and those individuals are named on this slide, as well as funding from awards that I've contributed myself to the work. I also want to acknowledge that a number of students have been involved in the work, and they are shown here, and they range from postdoctoral fellows to undergraduates. The chemical that I'm going to talk to you about, of course, is atrazine. By way of introduction, it is an S-chlorotriazine, shown here. So it's in the triazine family. It's an herbicide used with monocot crops, and primarily here it's used on corn. And by way of creating a common language, I want everyone to understand when I use the word pesticide, I mean anything that kills a pest. Oftentimes in generic usage, the word pesticide is equated with insecticide, but I mean anything that kills a pest, so a fungicide, an herbicide, a rodenticide, an insecticide are all pesticides. Atrazine itself is an herbicide specifically or a weed killer. It's been used for 48 years, and we use 80 million pounds annually in the United States. Until recently, it was the number one selling pesticide in the world. It has now been replaced by glyphosate. Glyphosate is now the number one selling compound. However, that has very little impact because we still use the same amount of atrazine, about 80 million pounds a year. It only means now that we use more glyphosate in addition to all of the atrazine that we use. It's used in more than 80 countries, but it's now outlawed in all of Europe, or as I often get corrected by my colleagues at Syngenta, it has technically been denied regulatory approval. But for all intents and purposes, it is now outlawed in Europe. And that's significant because the makers of atrazine, which were originally Ciba Geigy, which then became Novartis, and then Syngenta, are housed. Their home of these companies is in Switzerland, in Basel. So it's interesting that we're using 80 million pounds of a chemical that has, in fact, been outlawed in the country of origin. I'm going to talk to you very briefly about sort of three things. One, I'm going to talk to you about my work in amphibians. Then second, I'm going to talk to you about the relevance to human health, the relevance of these environmental health issues to human health. And then finally, I'm going to talk to you about some of the problems that are inherent in the EPA and I assume similar with the MPCA that prevent them from acting properly on atrazine or other chemicals in a way that's protective of environmental health and human health, or at least in a way that prioritizes environmental health and human health over financial and other reasons. The work I'm going to talk to you about initially was conducted on the African clawed frog shown here. It's a very common frog used in laboratory science, originally from Africa, but is now widely used around the world for the following reason. It was originally used in the medical field as a pregnancy test. It turns out that when these frogs are exposed to the hormone of pregnancy, so-called HCG, it induces these frogs to lay eggs. So literally, over 50 years ago, if you thought you were pregnant, you'd go to the doctor and he would inject the frog, and if the frog laid eggs, you were pregnant. Now, you know, I always make a little joke. I'm not sure who the first guy is who thought, gee, I wonder what will happen if I inject pee into a frog, but it was an important finding. And the reason I point it out is I want you to understand how close the hormones are between amphibians and humans. The hormones that I'm going to talk to you about, testosterone and estrogen, are exactly the same. They work exactly the same way. So when we see problems in these animals with chemicals that cause a hormone imbalance, it should raise concern for your health as well. And I think I can demonstrate that here today. What we showed in some of my earlier studies is that when you expose one of these frogs to atrazine at levels of 0.1 parts per billion, that's 0.1 micrograms per liter, and when you examine their reproductive organs, when you dissect them, here are the kidneys. And what you see here is an animal with two testes, two ovaries, a large testis, and more ovaries. So atrazine induced true hermaphroditism, both the mixture of male and female reproductive organs in this animal. We've since gone on to explore the mechanism by which atrazine induces this abnormality in the testis of male-exposed frogs. Testosterone, or the hormone of the testis, should be produced. Exact same testosterone that all the men in this room use that's important for making sperm and building muscle, etc. When exposed to atrazine, it turns on the enzyme, it turns on the machinery, if you will, that converts testosterone into estrogen, a word which literally means the generator of estrus. It is the so-called female hormone. The consequences of this imbalance now in males is that you are demasculinized, chemically castrated, your testosterone is depleted, and you're subsequently feminized because now you're making the female hormone when you shouldn't be if you're a male. We went on to show that, in fact, this was indeed the mechanism underlying this abnormal development. So we looked at blood levels of testosterone in male frogs. So they're a control male, so these are unexposed, untreated adult males. Here are the males that have been exposed to atrazine. And here's what normal female testosterone levels look like. So these males are demasculinized. Their male hormone levels are no different from a female. Next, we looked at expression of the gene for this machinery that would convert testosterone into estrogen. So here are males and females in the controls. So it is a female gene. And I should say this work was done in collaboration with colleagues outside of my laboratory. Here are the males that are resistant and don't respond. Here are the females that are exposed to, in this case, two doses of atrazine. And here are the malformed or hermaphroditic males. And we now know that these are genetic males. They're expressing a gene that should only be expressed at those levels in females. The next thing we did is we went to another amphibian model. And I should say that work was published by the National Academy of Sciences, everything I've showed you so far, peer-reviewed in one of the top journals. And then we went to another model. We looked at American leopard frogs and asked, do we see the same types of abnormalities in hormone imbalances? And when we looked at leopard frogs, and this work was peer-reviewed and published in Nature, when we looked at leopard frogs and dissected them, we found animals that, here's a testis, for example, and all of this at the back of the testis, these are all eggs that have developed in this male's testis and then, in fact, bursting through the surface of this male's testis. So this animal's a genetic male with testis, but instead of making sperm, he produces eggs, and he yolks up those eggs as if he were a female. The next thing we did is we went into the field. Now that we had this laboratory evidence, we went across the United States asking, do we find hermaphrodites in the field, and are they associated with atrazine contamination in the water? To give you an idea of the levels, and I think Paul Watzke can speak to this better than I can, to give you an idea of what it takes to produce these abnormalities and to put that into an ecological relevance, if you will, atrazine's application is recommended at the equivalent of 2.9 to 29 million parts per billion. If you look at the published literature, agricultural runoff has anywhere from 1 part per billion to 10,000 parts per billion. Here's what the minimum and maximum for temporary bodies of water, permanent water such as rivers and lakes, and here's now atrazine levels that are found in precipitation, including some data here from Minnesota. Here's what it takes to make hermaphroditic frog, this black line, and this, what should be red, the screen is transforming my colors a bit. What should be red here shows you all the areas where frogs would be at risk. There's enough atrazine in the rainwater to make hermaphroditic demasculinized frogs. 500,000 pounds of atrazine come down in the rainwater every year in the United States. Perry Jones, here at the U.S. Geological Survey, I met him here, actually, I think at an MPCA meeting. Perry Jones here has shown that you can measure atrazine in the rainwater in Minnesota when they apply it in Kansas. So it's traveling up to 600 miles from the point of application. The EPA, which I'll address in a minute, has a drinking water standard set at 3 parts per billion for atrazine. That means that 30 times the atrazine is allowed in your drinking water than we know to effectively chemically castrate and make hermaphroditic frogs. When we went into the field, we found that indeed I'm sorry, the colors really are being transformed here. We found that indeed, if we looked at animals collected in the field, this is a male, so they're the kidneys. This is the testis, which looks normal, but when you micro-dissect it, so imagine I'm slicing a salami. I'm going to fold out a slice for you. The color is different because of the stain we use under the microscope. We dye it so we can see it. There it is, magnified. And if you look at just this section, here are the animal's testicular tubules, just like we humans have. Inside these tubules are the nerve cells or the Sertoli cells. But instead of sperm, this male has eggs. So that's what looks like a slice through a boiled egg. That's an egg. That's an egg. That's an egg. So this male in the wild is making eggs instead of sperm. We've just last week completed a much broader study. We published that study in Nature, and we published it in the NIH journal. But now we're looking across, we've looked across the United States over 6 years and really evaluated the problem. And those data are just being analyzed now. But this map should give you an idea of the areas that are most at risk. The red areas show you the areas that have the most applications of atrazine, and this is based on sales. So southern Minnesota falls in one of the most intense areas in terms of atrazine use. The next thing we did, and I'm only going to talk briefly about this amount of work because I do want to move on to the public health concerns and other concerns, is we did what I call field simulations. After doing laboratory studies to help us figure out the mechanisms and what the problems really were, we conducted the field studies to find out if it was a real problem that existed in the real world. And by field simulations, I mean that when we go into the field and find these hermaphroditic frogs, even though we know atrazine will produce the effect in the laboratory, what we don't know in the field is how much these other pesticides or other factors might contribute. So we conducted a study that was just published this last year, published by the National Institutes of Health. We conducted a study that looked at all of these herbicides, all of these fungicides, and all of these insecticides used on a typical corn field, in this case modeled after Nebraska. We found that only atrazine produced the hermaphroditism, but we found that when these chemicals are combined, we see effects that are much greater than any one chemical alone. So, for example, we studied what I call a stress model, where natural environmental stressors might inhibit growth or immune function. These might be temperature, desiccation, or pond drying, which causes the tadpoles to be more crowded. And there's an interaction. If the temperature goes up, the pond dries up, the animals become more crowded. That induces a stress response. But further, we found that there's an interaction with the pesticides, whereby if the pond dries up, the pesticides become more concentrated, and those increased concentrations of pesticides stimulate a stress response that causes release of fat-soluble pesticides, increasing that stress response. Same stress hormones that we have. And we showed that that stress response can lead to damage of the thymus, shown here. That causes the animals to have immune system failure. The result in a laboratory is they're more likely to get diseases, in this case, flavobacterial meningitis. And in the field, in the wild, it increases parasite loads that, in this case, block the kidney and liver. As a result of those increased parasite loads, the kidney and liver can't function to metabolize and excrete the pesticides, and so the internal pesticide load increases even more. And I'll show you how we've tested this model. Others have suggested similar things. So, for example, of course, in Minnesota, I can't come here without talking about limb deformities. As I said on the radio this morning, the limb deformities of the type in Minnesota are not caused by pesticides. I've never suggested that they were. Pesticides do have a role, however. Of the type of limb deformities that have been described here in Minnesota and also in California and elsewhere, the limb deformities are caused by a parasite. Now, a study just came out of Colorado showing that ag runoff increases the nutrients in a pond, that increases the snail population, which is the intermediate host for the parasites. So the fertilizers increase the limb deformities by increasing the number of snails, which are the first host for the parasite. A study outside of my laboratory, another independent laboratory, has shown that atrazine decreases immune function in the snails, so they're more likely to get parasites. So you have the fertilizer increasing the number of snails, and then you have the atrazine decreasing the immune function of snails, so now you have more infected snails. And then another study published out of Pennsylvania showed by guy Joe Kiesecker, showed that atrazine decreases immune function in the frogs. And so they're more likely to get parasites and more likely to get the limb deformities. So the increasing number of limb deformities we're seeing today is really a combination, at least, of three factors, if not more. The increased fertilizer causing an increase in snails and the decreased immune function in both the snails and the frogs as a result of atrazine and perhaps other pesticides. Similarly, another study, which came out of Washington, showed that atrazine increases ranavirus, virus susceptibility, and yet another amphibian, the tiger salamander. So atrazine is having direct effects, as I'll show you, not just on the gonads, on the reproductive organs, but other effects, but it's also having indirect effects that are contributing, we believe, to the global amphibian decline and causing harm to amphibian populations in the wild. Now, the last piece of the puzzle is that we have been doing studies that aren't completed yet, where in addition to measuring animals in the field and in the lab, we're actually bringing the field into the lab. And these studies over the last 6 years, we've been collecting tens of thousands of gallons of water, freezing them in a laboratory, which allows us to look at the direct impact of water from these environments on animals from the same, on frogs from those same environments. And that's, if you want to know more details about the mixture studies, I have that on here, but for the sake of time, I pull the details of those studies out, but I'm perfectly willing to talk about them after if you want. What I really want to talk about now is a yet unpublished study where we're really starting to look at the impact of agriculture on amphibians in the wild. And the real question is, how do you look at that interaction between environmental stressors, disease, and pesticides in the real world? I mean, I can draw the arrows and make the model, but how do you really show that that's a reality or, you know, just something, just a hypothesis? We've done that by, instead of bringing the field into the lab, we've taken this model backwards and we've taken the lab into the field in our work in California. I'm going to talk to you very briefly about this continuing work on the Salinas, in the Salinas River Valley. The Salinas River flows this way. It's a highly productive agricultural area. 85% of the U.S. is lettuce, 14% of the U.S.'s total produce, 90% of the U.S.'s almonds are coming out of what's really just a little over 100-mile stretch of the Salinas Valley. Very intense agriculture. The area down here at the southern end, though, is quite protected, as I'll show you. It's, again, the colors are weird here, but it's about knee-deep, 2 foot of water, 22 degrees Celsius, and surrounded, as you'll see, by protected forests. The river dries up somewhere in here, and about 90 miles down, the water returns, but this water is all agricultural runoff. Again, 22 degrees, about knee-deep in water. This river looks the same as upstream. The difference is, and I'll show you the difference now, upstream of agriculture, and here's our site. This is taken from Google Earth. You can see that it's surrounded by mountains and trees to protect its San Padres National Forest. So it's a fairly pristine area. If we look downstream, you can see that it's surrounded by something different. Here's our site. This is the town of Salinas, and this whole patchwork is now the agricultural area that feeds, they call it, I think, the salad bowl of the U.S., that feeds the U.S. a great deal of its produce. So what are the consequences of living upstream of agriculture versus living downstream of agriculture? The model that I showed you would have predicted that if we compare Santa Margarita, the pristine site, with Salinas, the agricultural site, that you would have retarded development, because that's what we see when we add pesticide mixtures in the laboratory. And when we collect tadpoles from these two different sites, that's exactly what we see in the field. We would predict retarded growth based on our laboratory studies, and that's exactly what we see in the field. And they say a picture's worth a thousand words. These animals are the same age. They live 90 miles apart. The only difference is this animal lives upstream of agriculture in the pristine area, and this animal was taken downstream of the agriculture, downstream of water that's running off of our food. The next question is, how is the immune system affected? And here's what I mean by we took the lab into the field. The immune system is affected in the following way. We placed individual tadpoles in these cages at the site upstream of agriculture, and at the site downstream of agriculture. And then we exposed him to yeast, not a deadly disease, not a deadly pathogen, not a deadly virus, just bread yeast, like we just bought it from the grocery store. Upstream of agriculture, the next day the animals injected with yeast were fine. Downstream of agriculture, these animals were paralyzed and edemic, swollen, morbid, dead, morbid, dead. So these animals living downstream of agriculture can't survive exposure to simple bread yeast when injected in the field. So there's a huge impact and a huge role of atrazine and other pesticides on our aquatic wildlife and probably our wildlife in general. What I'd like to do now, unless we should stop for questions, what I'd like to do now is move on to talk about the relevance to human health and the potential impact of atrazine on human health based on what we've seen in our amphibian studies. I've often entitled this talk when I give it at in academic settings, From Silent Spring to Silent Night, a play on Rachel Carson's Silent Night. Rachel Carson warned that birds, our canary in the coal mine, that were dying primarily because of DDT exposure, she warned that the pending silent spring, no birds singing, was a warning to us, humans. And I'm going to argue that the decline in amphibians, and over 50% of the world's amphibian species are threatened or facing threatened or endangered status. I'm going to warn that pending silent night is telling us something about our human health, potentially through some of the same mechanisms. I usually use, in my classroom, I usually use this slide to express how blinded we've become by our current lifestyle. This is a site that I work at in Uganda, Nabugabo. It's a very rural village where the runoff from this crop, which they collect in these buckets, which is the sole source of drinking, bathing, cooking water for this village. I argue that the men in this village, if I told them, you know, the frogs are hermaphroditic and have failed immune system in that water, I argue that these men would immediately see the connection between environmental health and public health. Whereas I always joke, in my village, shown here, there's where the A's and the Raiders play. It's not all that different, though. My house is somewhere here, and if you look just behind my house, there's this so-called protected watershed that is my drinking source. So I don't collect it in a yellow kerosene container, but it's the same water that has 500,000 pounds of atrazine coming down that can have atrazine and other pesticides above levels that we know to be biologically active. The difference is my water comes out of a faucet, as does yours, and we sort of think that because we have these agencies in place that we don't have to worry about the kinds of things that I'm going to talk to you about today. Glenn Fox wrote that in ecoepidemiology, the occurrence of an association in more than one species and species population is very strong evidence for causation. In other words, he's saying if I can show in multiple species of amphibians that there's a problem with atrazine, it's probably not a coincidence. We've shown these effects in multiple species. Other labs, as I'll show you, have shown these effects in multiple species of frogs, genera, even families of frogs. What I won't have time to talk to you about, though, is it's not just frogs. Other laboratories around the world have shown effects in fish, decreasing testosterone, decreasing sperm, increasing estrogen, identical to what we've seen in frogs. There's studies in chickens, studies in alligators, studies in turtles that have shown the same thing. I am going to show you, though, studies in mammals. I'm going to show you lab rats, which we use to estimate the effects of these things on us. And I'm going to show you the human data, which should move you to support the bill that Senator Marty was talking about and hopefully move you to get rid of atrazine or do what you can to help get rid of it in the environment. I'm also going to talk to you about the testimony of Ann Lindsay. She testified here in Minnesota a few years ago. And at that time, she said that, I'm quoting her here, there is no direct scientific information to assess the hypothesis that I'm about to present to you. That hypothesis is that atrazine decreases testosterone and sperm production in mammals the same way it does in frogs and fish and turtles and alligators and birds. She argues that the work that I'm going to tell you about, represented by 40 peer-reviewed scientific published papers from almost as many laboratories, she says doesn't exist. In rats, all the way back in the year 2000, her testimony, I think, was 2005, EPA. All the way back in 2000, a lab in Europe showed that if you expose rats to atrazine, sperm count goes down. And these p-values I'm showing you is are if you are interested in statistics. In the year 2000. And now somebody brought up on the radio this morning that, well, the doses are different. They are different. But we don't know what these doses are. The doses that you see here are what was in the animal's food. Nobody's ever measured what ends up in their blood. Nobody's ever measured what ends up in their urine. And so nobody knows how to compare it to the frog data or to the human data. In the frogs, we just add it to the water. If you look in humans, Shauna Swan showed the following. She measured, actually, you'd be happy to know, she studied men in Minneapolis and did not see atrazine in the urine or any effects of men in the Twin Cities. But when she studied men in Missouri, where they use a lot more atrazine, she showed that there was a link between subfertility, and here's the p-value if you're interested and want to talk about it. She showed that there's a link between low sperm count and low fertility in men and how much atrazine is in their urine. And again, I don't know how to compare, but the amount of atrazine in their urine, 0.1 parts per billion, is the amount of atrazine it takes to knock out testosterone and demasculinize a frog. And just by coincidence, these men can't get their wives pregnant. Now, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to change the y-axis. Okay, the data's still there, but now the axis goes up to 240 parts per billion because a study in California in 1993, has nothing to do with my lab, separate lab, showed that here are the atrazine levels in field workers. And I'm going to change the axis again. Here are the atrazine levels in applicators of atrazine. The men who apply atrazine have 2,400 parts per billion atrazine in their urine on average. That's 24,000 times the atrazine that's associated with low fertility in men in Missouri. 24,000. That's 24,000 times what it takes to chemically castrate and make a hermaphroditic frog. Or if I can be kind of crude, one of these guys could pee in a bucket. I could dilute it 24,000 times. And I could use their urine to chemically castrate and make hermaphrodites out of 24,000 buckets of 30 tadpoles each. But nobody knows anything about the health care of these men because they're primarily Mexican migrant farm workers, many of which have life expectancies of 50. 24,000 times, and this is an underestimate. The Center for Disease Control just put out a study that shows that they've been measuring the wrong metabolites in these studies, and the levels are likely much higher. And up to 70% of all Americans are estimated to be exposed to atrazine. 70%. Higher burden, of course, in the areas of the country that were red in the slide that I showed you. The other half of the equation, which Ann Lindsay at the EPA says there's no evidence for, and again, I'm going to tell you there's over 40 papers, is that atrazine turns on aromatase and that it's associated with cancers, such as breast cancer and prostate cancer. In rats, which is surrogates for humans, rats exposed to atrazine, I already told you, have low testosterone, but they have a concomitant increase in estrogen. And here's what's interesting about Ann Lindsay's testimony. This study, Stoker 2000, 5 years before her testimony, this study was done in an EPA laboratory with a Syngenta scientist working in the laboratory. If you look at rodents, again, this was done in a Syngenta laboratory. Here's mammary tumor incidence and controls. Here are mammary tumor incidences in the animals exposed to atrazine. And again, the doses are what's in the food. Nobody knows actually what ends up in the blood or the urine of the rat. Syngenta claims that there's no increase in the incidence of tumors in this study, that they claim that the age of onset was just earlier, that if the controls live long enough, they would get the same cancer incidence. But that's like saying, you know, if you live long enough, you're going to die anyway. I find that unacceptable and an unacceptable way to explain away their data. This study looked at Sanderson et al. It's a European laboratory, so now we're back in Europe, with a Syngenta guy working in the laboratory, showed that if you expose human cancer cells to atrazine, there's controls, the cancer cells express aromatase. This gene that's responsible for making estrogen, that's associated with breast cancer. EPA says there's no evidence. This is a peer-reviewed publication. In 1997, 8 years before Ann Lindsay's testimony here, with a p-value of 0.0001, a study in Kentucky showed that women whose well water is contaminated with atrazine are more likely to develop breast cancer when compared to women who live in the same area but don't drink that well water. And here, I think, is the most clear evidence. Prostate cancer. Last time I testified, Tim Pastor with Syngenta was here, and I was talking about a study published in the Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine by the National Institutes of Health, and he complained, the study was done in their factory, by the way, he complained that I misrepresented the facts, and he constantly uses the term the farmers we serve. So what I'm going to do today to make sure that you know that I'm not misrepresenting the facts is I'm going to read to you directly from their paper. This is not my interpretation. This is Syngenta's publication in that Journal of Occupational Environmental Medicine published by the National Institutes of Health. This is exactly as they wrote it. I'm not misrepresenting anything, just so you're clear. On page 1052, they wrote, quote, "The increase in all cancers combined seen in the overall study group was concentrated in the company employee group." That's Syngenta. They wrote on page 1052, "The increase in prostate cancer in male subjects was concentrated in the company employees." They wrote on page 1053, "The prostate cancer increase was further concentrated in actively working company employees." So if you actually go to work, you're more likely to get prostate cancer. They wrote on page 1052, quote, "All but one of the cases occurred in men with 10 or more years since hire." So if you're loyal to the company that serves the farmers, then you're more likely to get prostate cancer. That's my interpretation. I'm reading to you from their paper. And finally, I think most significantly, they wrote on page 1053, quote, "Analysis restricted to company employees, restricted to Syngenta employees, also found that the prostate cancer increase was limited to men under 60 years of age." Now, nationally, 80% of all prostate cancer cases are in men over 65. These men are 50 years old, actively working for more than 10 years. That's where their prostate cancer is concentrated. And then he's using terms like the farmers we serve. He claimed before the House that they just have better statistics and better screening of their employees. But when I show you this graph, I'm comparing their active employees, their exposed males, to their control males or inactive employees. They get the same prostate checks. 8.4-fold higher, young men, age 50, actively working, loyal to the company for more than 10 years. That's what a prostate cancer was clustered. It's not my interpretation. It's no misrepresentation. I read to you what they wrote. So I find it curious that Ann Lindsay says there's no evidence. I only told you about a few of the papers. I don't have time to go through all 40. The first time I testified here was on March 15th. I remember I walked in and I said, although it is the Ides of March, I am not here to bury or to praise atrazine, just to give you the facts. And I took that approach because I was trained as an academic that you don't get involved. I was taught that you don't advocate. I was taught that you let the data speak for itself. And the first time I was ever called a scientist and an activist, I was actually offended. That's the line. Minnesota made me cross the line. Minnesota made me cross the line because the data doesn't always speak for itself. Sherry Ford of Syngenta, in a press release relating to Minnesota, said, "Research that we have funded does not support the conclusions that Hayes is drawing from his own research." Well, it turns out that if you go through the literature, there are 38 papers in the published literature that show adverse effects of atrazine versus 9 studies that suggest there's no effect of atrazine. Now, I'm a pretty hard worker, but all 30 of these papers ain't mine. I do other stuff, too. I'm blocking out these in gray, so you can take it down to what's at 33, because the gray studies actually looked at atrazine mixed with other pesticides. So atrazine is just a contributor. These effects range from this study by Ho et al., not my lab, that showed that atrazine increases mortality after 24 or 60 hours. These studies are studies like Diana et al. It shows that atrazine decreases growth. And we're talking all about frogs right now. These are studies like Storrs and Kiesecker that shows that atrazine decreases frog survivorship. These are studies like a study in Canada, which was the first. I'm one of the few scientists who brags about what I didn't do. I was not the first to discover that atrazine affects reproductive organs. That was discovered in Canada back in 2002, before my study. Atrazine affects everything from general toxicity to immune failure to neurotoxicity, adverse behavior, retarded growth, retarded development, and it induces sexual deformities. The 9 studies that say that atrazine does nothing are all funded by Syngenta, and the 38 studies that says that atrazine has adverse effects, none of them were funded by Syngenta. I did a statistic to see if that was just random, and with a p-value of, 10 to the negative 8, we normally only take 0.05 as significant. The biggest predictor of whether or not atrazine has no effect is who paid for it. And what's interesting is they've only looked at gonadal effects, reproduction, and they're all the same authors. They just reshuffle each other's names. So really, there's only one laboratory that says there's no effect, and they're all funded by Syngenta. The other interesting thing is the lead author of those studies have written things like, he finally backtracked. I don't think his data contradicts Hayes. He says, my research speaks for itself. I am not responsible for how Syngenta chooses to characterize it. He backed up on us. He published a paper saying he couldn't reproduce my data. Now he says Syngenta just painted it that way. He also wrote, after he published and released press releases saying he couldn't repeat my data, the important issue is for everyone involved to come to grips with and stop minimizing the fact that independent laboratories have demonstrated an effect of atrazine on gonadal differentiation in frogs. There is no denying this, he says. This is the guy working for the company who produced a paper that Syngenta claims couldn't repeat my work. This is the lead author on the 9 studies funded by Syngenta that says atrazine has no effect. And what's more interesting is, there's a study right there, just came out in 2006. Let me read to you what that study says. That study said, ovaries from animals treated with nitrate or atrazine exhibited larger immature and mature follicles. In conclusion, the study has demonstrated changes in sex ratios that are more marked in response to combined nitrate atrazine exposure than with these chemicals alone. It says, since these effects occur without major changes in animal growth or general morphological development, they are likely to reflect specific endocrine or reproductive mechanisms that are occurring at environmentally realistic exposure concentrations. Jim Carr was an author on that paper, but that paper wasn't funded by Syngenta. It was funded by the Declining Amphibian Population Task Force. So you have 9 studies funded by Syngenta that say atrazine doesn't do anything. And then when the one guy moves over without Syngenta funding, he says it's a specific and occurs at realistic, ecologically relevant doses. So I crossed the line because the science wasn't speaking for itself. Even according to the own author, Syngenta was speaking for the science. I crossed the line because when the EPA got the data, they said, well, since there's some confusion, we have to repeat it all. And they gave the company 4 years. The company has to do it, 4 years to do it. And they said, if the company can't repeat it, that's the end of it. They said, but even if the company can repeat it, we need another 10 years of field studies. And then we got to go back and redo the whole mechanism again because the EPA somehow can't go to the library and get the papers I just told you about. I crossed the line because the work that they proposed here would take 40 years if you add up how much time they're giving the company to do it. Work that's already represented in 38 published studies from scientists everywhere from Japan to Europe and the U.S. If the EPA had existed in 1973 with this model that's supposed to protect us and the environment, DDT would have had another 7 years. Because it was another 7 years before the laboratory data showed that it caused eggshell thinning in birds. DDT would have had another 25 years because it was not until 1988, after they removed DDT, that they showed that the eggshell thinning was reversed in the field. In fact, DDT would still be on the market. Because in 2006, a laboratory wrote, the mechanism for contaminant-induced eggshell thinning in wild birds remains to be clarified. So we've moved backwards. I crossed the line because I don't think we can wait 40 years for the EPA to tell Syngenta, the manufacturer, to produce data that's already represented by over 40 papers in the literature. I think something has to start now, and I think it has to start here. I crossed the line because the EPA has given you inaccurate information. Here's the most important thing you need to know. You can forget everything I've said today. You can assume that all those papers I told you about were wrong. You can assume that I'm some crazy madman who just likes to find any excuse to come back to the Twin Cities. But you remember this. Here's what breast cancer is. It's when a cell gets damaged. And in the case of breast cancer, that damaged cell becomes a tumor because of the estrogen receptor, 70% of the time. Here's how much we know about aromatase's role in breast cancer. Women are more likely to get breast cancer after menopause. That means that you're not getting breast cancer because you have higher estrogen. Your estrogen's down after menopause. But what we know now is that the breast cancer itself makes aromatase, makes its own estrogen, and turns into a tumor. Now, you don't have to believe me. Here's who you have to believe. Don't believe Tyrone, but believe this. Here's how much we know about the importance of aromatase in the number one cancer in women. We sell drugs, letrozole. They work by blocking aromatase, by reducing estrogen, and the company that makes letrozole claims it's 1,000 times better than any other breast cancer treatment on the market. Believe that, because that's what they're selling you. While another company is exposing 70% of all Americans to a chemical that turns on aromatase and induces breast cancer in rats and is associated with breast cancer in humans. Believe that, because it's not coming from me. Novartis Oncology offers treatments for cancer that range from breast cancer. So the company that's selling you letrozole, there are two of them. The company that is selling you aromatase blockers are Novartis and AstraZeneca. They claim that knocking out aromatase is 1,000 times better at treating breast cancer. Novartis and AstraZeneca. Go on their website. Do you know who Syngenta is? Syngenta was the merger between Novartis' agrochemicals and AstraZeneca agrochemicals. So don't believe me. What I want you to believe is Novartis. Novartis has the truth. But you need to call them. They didn't show up today, my buddy Tim Pastor. You need to call them and ask which is true. Does atrazine turning on my aromatase give me breast cancer? Or does your letrozole turning off aromatase treat my breast cancer? Because a five-year-old knows that both of those things can't be true. You need to call Novartis and ask, if I have breast cancer and I'm taking your aromatase blocker and drinking your aromatase inducer, who's going to win? And why am I paying you on both sides of the equation? Why am I paying you to turn on my aromatase and then turn around paying you to turn it off again? Don't believe me. Believe this one slide. That's the slide that made me cross the line. I crossed the line because of the prostate and mammary cancer that's been shown in rats, and I believe that's a model for humans. If we're going to test products to take drugs to the market on rats and assume safety for humans, how can we ignore when we get a negative effect in the rat when it comes to human health? I didn't have time to talk about it, but atrazine causes immune failure in rats, several studies, just like it does in frogs. Not mine, somebody else did it. Atrazine, there's several studies that have come out that shows that if you're exposed in utero, atrazine causes neural damage in rats and behavioral disorders, and a study just came out that showed that women who get pregnant during peak atrazine season, their babies have learning disabilities. Just published. I crossed the line really, though, for this reason. An EPA laboratory, the same EPA that told you that there's no evidence for atrazine's adverse effects. An EPA laboratory shows that atrazine causes abortion in 4 strains of rats. Published, peer-reviewed. An EPA laboratory showed that rats that don't abort, their sons come out with prostate disease. If the mother's drinking atrazine while she's breastfeeding in rats, the sons come out with prostate disease, and you're never going to prove that in humans, because if my mother was exposed to atrazine and I get prostate cancer when I'm 50, there's no way you're going to prove it. But the DES model in rats shows us that what we find out in rats tells us something about humans. An EPA laboratory shows that if a mother is exposed to atrazine, her babies, her daughters come out with impaired mammary development, impaired breast development. This is the third EPA laboratory, same EPA that says there's no evidence. That's what a normal breast looks like under the microscope for a rat. That little tiny thing with all the buds missing is what happens if her mother was drinking atrazine. And when that female rat grows up, her breasts don't make enough milk, and her pups show impaired growth and development. This poor mouse, this poor rat, was never exposed to atrazine. Her grandmother was. So I crossed the line because when I think about my daughter and her daughter, when I think about the fact that the atrazine that we're applying now could affect my granddaughter, I can't just come in and let the data speak for itself, because you've got an agency that you trust telling you that there is no data when the same agency produced the data. When I look at the evidence in France that shows that atrazine's been banned for 20 years, it's still in the aquifers. It's not about me and you. We've already been exposed. It's not about my daughter. My daughter's already been exposed. Atrazine, if we stop today, would be around another 20 years. My granddaughter has already been exposed. So we're talking about my granddaughter's granddaughter, your granddaughter's granddaughter. We're talking about a chemical that, because of the way we plant our corn, we waste 21% because of the center pivot irrigation. We're talking about a chemical that's used on corn, a crop that we eat less than 2% of. Here's where the rest of it goes. So we're talking about a chemical that does all those things that I've told you to frogs, to fish, to turtles, to birds, to rats, to humans, a chemical that at best increases corn yield by 1.2% of a crop that we only eat 1.8% of, in a world where 20% suffer from malnutrition and don't have access to basics like grain, like the corn that we're now going to convert into alcohol and use coal burning to produce the ethanol that's driven the price of corn up 4 times, so that this 50% that used to go to cows and pigs is going to drive all of our food prices up. It starts here in Minnesota. I want to thank the USGS for sending me this picture, but this goes well, well beyond the granddaughters of the granddaughters of the people of Minnesota. What you dump into water goes down to towards Missouri. And in that corn belt, that's where you have these people with these high levels of atrazine because of those applications. What they dump into water goes on down the Mississippi, where you end up in Missouri with these men with low sperm counts and low fertility. And eventually, what you dump into your rivers, into your watersheds, goes into the Gulf of Mexico, 1.2 million pounds of atrazine per year. That's right outside the Syngenta factory. I couldn't get inside the gate. That's a pipe that delivers something right into the Mississippi River, most of which looks like this. That's where their plant is, where 8.4-fold higher incidence of prostate cancer occur. 80% African-American. Black men are 4 times more likely to die of prostate cancer. Black women are 2 times more likely to die of breast cancer. So it's not just about Minnesota that I crossed the line. The EPA wrote in an article just in 2006, after they're going to do all this science, it's going to take 40 years, ignoring all the science that Ann Lindsay told you doesn't exist, they wrote, the ultimate decision is much bigger than science. It weighs in public opinion. And I crossed the line because I want to make sure that the public has the right information to be able to make that decision. I can stop here if you want, but I had some more testimony from Ann Lindsay that I wanted to introduce to you to show you what your legislature was given when she testified. And I couldn't be here. She wrote, Ann Lindsay in 2005, I want to show you how many heads, how many mouths the Environmental Protection Agency has. She wrote in 2005, she said, before the Minnesota legislature, that the EPA, however, has never seen either the results from any independent investigator published in peer-reviewed scientific journals or the raw data from Dr. Hayes' additional experiments. She claims she never saw my data. In 2002, the EPA, Tom Steger, had written to me, Tyrone, Although you are not required to provide EPA with any information, you have been very cooperative and have shared both the raw data and standard operating procedures from your research. Additionally, you have spent a considerable amount of time helping the Office of Pesticide Programs to understand the significance of your data, and you have provided insightful reviews of similar research efforts. Because, see, once I got on my naivete, once I realized the company wasn't going to do the right thing, I thought, well, I'll work with the EPA. 2002, I give them all my data. 2005, they said they never saw it. These emails can be authenticated. They came over two public servers. You can FOIA them. Ann Lindsay wrote or said to you, none of the studies on atrazine were conducted in accordance with standard protocol. So they said they can't use my data because I didn't use standard protocol, even though it's published in the two top journals, two of the three top journals in the world. She said that in 2005. She also said to you in that legislative, because there are no standardized test methods for any of these studies, she's claiming that I didn't use standard protocol when there isn't one. You see, EPA's got many heads and many mouths. She said to you, there's no direct scientific information to assess this hypothesis that atrazine is an endocrine disruptor. In 2000, the EPA wrote in a peer-reviewed published paper, and if I can get it from the library, I'm pretty sure Ms. Ann Lindsay, Dr. Ann Lindsay, can get it. In 2000, the EPA wrote, 2000 is before I published anything on atrazine, by the way. Okay, so I'm bragging again now, but what I didn't do. They wrote, quote, atrazine tested positive in a pubertal male screen that the EDSTAC, Endocrine Disruptor Screening and Testing Committee, is considering as an optional screen for endocrine disruptors. EPA wrote that. She says there's no evidence, the test hypothesis. In 2000, EPA says atrazine's an endocrine disruptor. I don't know. Here's part of the problem. The EPA is supposed to regulate Syngenta. That's why they call them the Environmental Protection Agency. Syngenta has these scientific advisory boards. These scientific advisory boards consult study panels. Study panels can talk to contract labs. The study panels can publish in scientific journals. That goes all the way back up. They report to the EPA. There's a scientific advisory panel, which is meeting right now, by the way. And there's even this Endocrine Disruptor Screening and Testing Committee. So there's a lot of checks and balances. So why are we spending all of our time? Part of the problem is, sometimes the same guy just pops up all over again, all over the place, working for Syngenta. He's on the SAPs. He's on the Endocrine Disruptor Screening and Testing Committees. They produce vice presidents that go on to work at Syngenta, such as Gary Dixon. Verna Kloas, an EPA panel member, just went to work for Syngenta, and that's the only work they're reviewing right now for atrazine's effects on frogs. And there's even a Syngenta guy working in the EPA laboratory who publishes all those data that EPA says they don't know about. That's exactly why when Syngenta does something illegal, such as the EPA wrote me in 2002, they wrote, because I helped them bust these guys, they wrote, I am deeply disturbed at the news that Syngenta, formerly Novartis and EcoRisk, had access to your data and your analyses, but failed to report these findings to the EPA. He continued, I believe you have sufficiently documented that Syngenta and EcoRisk had prior knowledge of atrazine's adverse effects. They could face some hefty fines plus a lot of negative publicity. They went under federal investigation. The Natural Resources Defense Council sued the EPA, filed a FOIA, and found out that every piece of evidence I sent to EPA, they forwarded to Syngenta, and all the data got submitted and covered up. I crossed the line for that reason. I'm going to stop there, but if I can have 5 minutes, I'd like to read, less than five, I'd like to read something that I think is relevant to what this bill and what this committee, I hope, will successfully do. I started working with some colleagues in Australia and Tasmania. 50,000 strong grassroots citizens are fighting atrazine and destructive forestry practices in Tasmania. And as a result of discovery and FOIA practices, they turned up this letter written in 1994. And I think it's relevant to what this committee is about to do. The letter is an internal document by Siba Gaidi. It's entitled Subject Siba Gaidi Meeting on Atrazine, August 16th, 1994. In attendance were someone from Siba Gaidi, North Forest Products, Chemical Safety Evaluation Unit, Director of Public Health, the Allen Consulting Group, and Forestry Tasmania. Internal memo. The thrust of the meeting was how to deal with the use of atrazine as a chemical herbicide. It was recognized that it is a part of a bigger issue of anti-chemical use and anti-forestry in Tasmania. They're destroying native old-growth forest. They wrote, there's a wealth of information available on the scientific aspects of the chemical. Discussion hinged around the role of the National Registration Authority and the public review process that is underway for the review of existing registered chemicals. This is a role that the National Registration Authority has under its charter to systematically review the registration status of all agriculture and veterinary chemicals currently registered in Australia. The process as to how this is to be undertaken is still being investigated. This is kind of the equivalent of their EPA panel. An additional function of the NRA is an ad hoc review of any chemical it considers should be reviewed for whatever reason. Now, here's the interesting part. Siba Geigy, now Syngenta, is contemplating asking the NRA to undertake such a review. They're interfering in the regulatory process. Even if a review of atrazine was undertaken by NRA under either the above two mechanisms and it was clear, there's no security for the chemical as it could be politically, and this is in quotes, canned. If there is too much controversy over its use, these reviews are open for public input so anti-chemical people can have, quote, their day in court. It was resolved that a three-point approach should be taken. SIGA to update its product information booklets and distribute widely to appropriate people and organizations. They will approach us later for additional names. Two, SIBA and National Forests to set up a team to liaise with key people, Minister of Agriculture, Health, Environment, etc. Three, SIBA is floating the idea of approaching NRA and asking for an ad hoc review of atrazine. He would like our support of such an approach. And finally, they wrote, in the USA, this is the year that Syngenta Novartis started the EcoRisk project that hired me as a consultant and that kicked off the EPA's review of atrazine. They wrote in the final paragraph, in the USA, the EPA is under pressure to review atrazine. The American approach is very closely linked with the legalistic implications of any decision. Atrazine is a big product for SIBA in the USA, and they want to vigorously defend its use in that country. The parent company in Switzerland, which has banned atrazine, by the way, is still very anxious about the discrepancies of use rates around the world. Jim Swain floated the idea of bringing some of the executives from Basel out to look at sites in Tasmania so they can get a better appreciation of the differences between forestry and agricultural use of the chemical. Australia is prone to any overseas issues on atrazine. The meeting was very positive, and I believe Siba Geigy will be making a positive approach to outline the uses of their product. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Hayes. When you talked about Dr. Lindsay's testimony, that was before the Minnesota House?
That is correct, I believe, yes.
Questions from the committee? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just first, the gentleman that Dr. Hayes referred to that takes issue with some of his data, was that individual invited? He expressed some regret that he wasn't here. Was he invited to appear before
the committee? Mr. Pastor, you mean?
Pastor has been here in the past, correct.
Yeah, he came to our hearing on atrazine earlier. He usually, I think he's often where you are. I did not invite him here today because last time we had a hearing, when I was chair of the Environment Committee, a hearing with Dr. Hayes, and we had Syngenta people here, and they didn't care to testify then. And I actually remember at a forum that same year with St. Thomas where there was a lobbyist for Syngenta in the audience, and one of the students asked if Syngenta was represented there, and the guy just ignored the comment, didn't move, and walked out of the room a minute later. And so I kind of figure Syngenta always seems to know where Dr. Hayes is. They usually seem to be there. They're always happy to comment and tell people what the flaws of his research are, but they never seem to be interested in speaking when he speaks because he can rebut it. But, I mean, I'm happy to invite them. I just know that in the past when they've been here, they didn't want to testify. But when Dr. Hayes is not here, they seem to be very eager to, though.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just was curious about that because there was some regret expressed that he wasn't here, and I guess there are things that may be debatable that are beyond my pay grade to be familiar with.
And,
but I did have a question for Dr. Hayes, and thank you for coming and appreciate your testimony. I can't help. You made some reference to the DDT and the banning of DDT and the actions the EPA took in 1972 to do that. And I think that in some ways is a little bit curious because I recently, actually back in July, there was an article in the National Geographic that talked about the resurgence of malaria, in particularly in Africa and other countries, and they linked it very directly to the banning of DDT. And the question, and then I started to look out on the internet and do some reading about it, and what I discovered, and maybe I'm wrong about it, but what the facts seem to be is that the banning of DDT was shouldn't have been banned, that it may be there are questions raised about the kind of application that it was done. But the fact seems to be that there was no human deaths related to DDT, but since the banning of DDT, there's been something conservatively estimated in the National Geographic of some 40 or 50 million people, notably children in Africa, who have died because of the inability to access that chemical to use to control mosquitoes. In some countries where there had been use of DDT prior to the banning, they had completely eradicated malaria, and since that time, the cases have skyrocketed. So if the parallel is that what we're doing with atrazine is similar to what we're doing with DDT, that would cause me to question whether we ought to proceed in doing things like banning atrazine without maybe understanding the effects of it completely. And that's why I was asking if there are questions that could be raised or a debate ought to occur that that would help us to shed some light on what the status of this is. And I grant I'm not a scientist, and I found your presentation to be very interesting. I think, again, looking at some data that's publicly available, there are questions raised about laboratory studies, and I think even you mentioned that atrazine has been in the system. People have been living amongst atrazine for 40 years. Some of the effects that you suggest are going to happen in the future, you'd think should have already happened in the sense that there should be a huge amount of disruption. But I haven't read anything to link that occurs. Can you comment on that? Is there something that we're missing here, that if we've had 40 years of application of atrazine at a constant rate, and that there should be people today that would be able to say, well, this has affected me? And could you comment on that?
You raise very good points. First, I will comment on the last part. We've had 40-plus years of atrazine, and what's happened to the rates of breast cancer and prostate cancer over those 40 years? They're level now, but they've increased over those 40 years.
Mr. Chair?
And, yes?
It's directly to that statement, so I wanted to ask. That's true, but how can you pin that back to atrazine?
I said that already in my talk. You can't. If I'm exposed to atrazine and I get prostate cancer at 50, but if I have rat studies that we can look over a lifetime and know what they're exposed to, and we have the correlative epidemiological evidence, then to me that's strong evidence. If we have aromatase induced in every vertebrate animal that's been studied, and any single study, you can find something you don't like about it. But if you have 40 studies across multiple countries, multiple species, independent laboratories showing the same thing, then I'm going to gamble, get rid of atrazine, over have my granddaughter be exposed. With regards to the DDT, it's more complicated than that. And in fact, I testified, or I was at a briefing before U.S. Congress where I raised many of the same issues that you did. When DDT was banned in the U.S., it was banned for use in the U.S. except for an emergency, and no such emergencies have arisen during that time. And to say that DDT should not be banned in the U.S. when we had the environmental problems, and a paper just came out just in the last month showing that children exposed to DDT are more likely to develop breast cancer and other cancers when they grow up. There are human impacts. So to say that it shouldn't be banned in the U.S. is inappropriate. When you make the argument about malaria in Africa for emergency use, and also remember you're talking about spraying it on walls and mosquito nets, not widespread use and fogging of DDT. If you talk about the use of DDT in those emergency situations, along with proper management of water and proper treatment of water to help get rid of it, not DDT as a long-term solution, but as a short-term solution along with other integrated pest management control, it's exactly what I testified before U.S. Congress people over. But to say it shouldn't have been banned in the U.S., it's not. I would have to disagree. The health risks greatly outweigh any possible advantage we'd have for using DDT in the U.S. or from using it indiscriminately in Africa or Central and South America. I'm not Mr. Anti-Pesticide. I weigh him out. When I look at the 1.2% increase in yield and when I look at all the studies stacking up, I don't want my child to drink it. And I don't – my ethical system mandates that I should want the same thing for all children that I want for mine. That's where I'm coming from.
But thank you for your question. Dr. Hayes, thank you. I appreciate that. And I don't suspect you are anti-pesticide. But my point is that the effect of banning DDT in the United States was it led to a worldwide ban because the people who manufacture it and – well, the narrative seems to suggest that that's how it occurred, that that's why it's not used widely in third world countries. And that's what the National Geographic reported.
Yeah, that's not true.
Incorrect. But I think that the point you're making, and I would agree with it, is that pesticides can be very beneficial if they're applied properly and used properly. And I think the question with atrazine is it being applied and used properly? And are there benefits to the use of atrazine that have advantages to the human population, maybe not just for food uses, but for economic purposes? And are those things a bad thing to encourage? And so is there any attempt to balance the benefits of using pesticides or herbicides to control or to help to grow crops? If that's being done in a responsible way, should we then ban it? Or should we say, well, if there are instances where it's not being used appropriately, can we find a way to use it appropriately? And instead of taking the approach of DDT and banning it altogether, say, well, let's make sure that how we're using it is being used effectively. And why wouldn't we apply that same approach to atrazine? Or what you seem to be saying is that atrazine is just a bad chemical, should never be used ever under any circumstances for any purpose. And if that's the point, I guess, why would we take that position when we wouldn't take that with DDT?
One is the reason that I brought up the new bill that's here, Health First. So I'm not saying everybody wants to make a buck, want to grow a little bit more. There's other things to consider. But think about children and environmental health first. That has to be weighted heavily, and that's why I would support. That's why I support the bill that's been discussed here. In the case of DDT, the environmental impacts of indiscriminately using DDT and what we now know to be the health effects when it's not used properly, we'd have to have that discussion. Europe already had the discussion that you're talking about. They've said it's potentially biologically active at 0.1 parts per billion. It cannot be used in a way that it goes below 0.1 parts per billion. It's persistent. It's around for 20 years. It's gone. You weigh it out. 1.2% increase in corn yield. Some claim that it helps with erosion, but no data or evidence that I've seen. Versus demasculinizing wildlife, low sperm count, 2,400 parts per billion in the urine of men who apply it, wearing the equipment that they're supposed to wear, 8.4-fold increase in prostate cancer in factories in an African-American community, 80%, where there's already a 4-fold death rate in prostate cancer and a 2-fold higher death rate from breast cancer, when the same company selling an aromatase blocker and selling you an aromatase inducer. We could talk all day and you won't get me to agree with you.
And Mr. Chairman and Dr. Hayes, I appreciate that, but your testimony would seem to suggest that the conclusion we should reach is that the people of Syngenta are essentially criminals, murderers, and that we should lock them up and put them in prison because they are knowingly doing things that they know to cause harm to people. And is that your testimony? I just want to be clear. That would seem to be what you're suggesting. I just want to make sure that that's what you are suggesting.
Let me speak through somebody else's words. Congressman Keith Ellison has a bill in the ban atrazine. That bill includes criminalization with 6 years in prison for the production and use.
And Mr. Chairman,
well, I'm not the only one who thinks
that. Dr. Hayes, I appreciate your opinion or Congressman Ellison's opinion, but I'm just trying to make sure that I understand. Your testimony is that there is a conspiracy, that this company is a conspiracy of criminals, murderers, and so forth that will do anything to make money, even if it results in great harm, which to me goes back to the question I raised originally, is that if there is legitimate debate about the science, and as I said, I'm not a scientist, and I've read a little bit about this, obviously not at the level that you would have, but there do seem to be legitimate questions about dosages and concentrations. I read something, in fact, last night that talked about to emulate the kind of contamination that would be done in laboratories, for example, human beings would have to consume something on the order of 3,000 gallons of water a day for an extended period of time to reach that same level that was approached. And I don't know, but I'm just that my question is if there are other people who are more conversant with the scientific literature, we ought to maybe have them here to testify about the 40 studies that you say prove this. The number of them isn't important to me. It's the quality of the study and whether they are really based on sound science.
The studies that I mentioned to you, I've told you, they're done by EPA and Syngenta themselves. Those are the ones I showed you. And the comment you just made, I don't know where you read it, is incorrect. Atrazine has the impact on cancer cells at part per billion. That's been done in Asia. It's been done in Europe. It's been done in the U.S. And men who work around the stuff are urinating 24,000 times that. 2,400 times that. So the studies you're talking about are when they look at the rats and they look at what's in the food. Nobody actually knows. Syngenta doesn't know. EP doesn't know. They never even measured what ends up in the rat's blood and the rat's urine. What I can tell you is that human cell lines are responsive to atrazine in the parts per billion range, and men working in these fields are urinating 240 parts per billion, 2,400 parts per billion, and there are very strong p-values associating atrazine exposure with low fertility, breast cancer, prostate cancer, the exact same types of effects that are induced in rats with mechanisms that are consistent with fish, frogs, turtles, alligators. CDC, Center for Disease Control, Environmental Protection Agency, Syngenta, National Institutes of Health. That's where these papers are coming from.
And so, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Hayes, then your testimony is that in addition to the criminal conspiracy being engaged in by this company, Syngenta, there's also, it's involving the government agents, the EPA and others, who are co-conspirators in this plan.
Mr. Hand, you're putting some strong words. The tobacco industry is one of many industries that does produce a product that kills people. We don't usually call them murderers, nor do we call the federal government, which allows it to be sold, murderers. These are dangerous chemicals. And
what I'm trying to get at is, and that's why I'm asking the witness if he would clarify his testimony, because the burden of his testimony would suggest that there is this criminal conspiracy, because he's saying that these people know that these things cause these diseases with certainty, and they do it anyway for profit. And so if that's the testimony and that the EPA is also engaged in aiding that, then how can you conclude anything otherwise than the testimony is you have a vast criminal conspiracy being conducted by the EPA and this company to the detriment of the population of the country? Is that your testimony, Doctor?
I don't want to overestimate my speaking abilities, but I think my testimony has been very clear. Yeah. And just for the record, I have not used the word murder or criminal. I have responded telling you that there is a bill which does criminalize it. I will also respond by telling you that Henry Waxman's office is looking at an investigation of the EPA's role with Syngenta and the atrazine case. I will also point out to you that the EPA themselves launched a criminal investigation against Syngenta. But the words that you're using are not words that came out of my mouth. Okay. They're you interpreting what I said, and I think I've been very clear.
And Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I'm not trying to suggest that you're saying that. I'm just trying to draw the conclusion that your testimony is that there are people who know that this is a product that causes these things. They know that with certainty.
Correct.
That they're hiding it from the public.
Correct.
That they're involved with the EPA to keep that knowledge from the public.
Correct.
And they're doing that to make money.
And it's not the first time it's happened.
And all I'm saying is that you put all those things together, and I read that, even though you have not said it, as that there is a vast co-conspiracy involving the agency of the federal government known as the EPA and this private company to do harm to the public. Now, that you haven't said that, and I don't want to have it be – I'm not saying that you said that, but that's the only conclusion that one can draw from your testimony. I'm just asking if that is the only conclusion we can draw, or should we draw some other conclusion? You're not allowing that this is a mistake or that there's – misinterpretation of data, or that there's a debate about the data. You're saying there is no debate. So what conclusion should we draw other than that one?
I think I've been very clear.
Okay.
I've said very clearly that I think atrazine should be banned. I said very clearly that I would very much support, both on the federal level and on the state level, an agency that puts health first. There's uncertainty in any health, any benefit, and any risk. Health should be first. And we should err on the side of caution. I think I've been very clear.
And Senator Hand, your final comment about whether they are intentionally producing a product that they know harms people. There are many manufacturers who produce products that they know harm people. That's where we put in regulation to say how much harm we're going to allow.
But Mr. Chairman, I agree with that. And that goes back to the point we were raising before.
I did 2 years ago and would later in the hearing ask if there is somebody from Syngenta here, and I think maybe because you did raise the question, and now I will ask if anybody in the audience is representing in some way Syngenta. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bruce Clavin. In response to your question, Mr. Chairman, I do have a contract with Syngenta. It started last December. I didn't know that Dr. Hayes was going to be here today until the emails between the ag guys went around this morning about the NPR. So whether they knew it or not, I don't know. But I was coming here today to cover for the ag groups, and like I normally would do as you were environment chair over the years, this is an ag issue, so I just came to monitor it. So what okay. The company knew about the presentation today, I couldn't tell you.
Okay. Well, we heard before we could even invite the ag department and I guess it was Health Department, we were told within an hour of when the notice went out a couple of weeks ago, they already knew by that time. So we didn't have to invite them. We talked with them, and I guess Ag Department's interested in testifying. But I kind of figured Syngenta would know as soon as the Ag Department knows. I don't mean that cynically, but I do mean that Syngenta does have a lot of people in Minnesota who are watching this. But
Chairman,
do you have any comments you would like to make?
Just that when I read the notice, I think the title was Atrazine, Public Health and Scientific Integrity, so I wrote it on the calendar, and I never looked at it again. If you had posted Dr. Hayes, I never saw it after that. So I just calendared and showed up.
Okay. Senator Erickson Ropes, and then Senator Wergen, then Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hayes, and I'll just direct my comments to you. I first want to recall something that you said when you first started, that you're here to present information and data and let the conclusions, you know, people draw their own conclusions. So I just want to remind the committee that the information that we've received from Dr. Hayes, in my opinion, was the research that he'd done and facts and data, and that was his presentation, and the conclusions that people may come up with, like Senator Han was drawing, are the job of this committee and others, perhaps, to make those conclusions. It's not the doctors, I think, to present the conclusions, but the information and data. Dr. Hayes, I found your presentation very compelling. I have heard it in the past. Research and data and charts of chemical structures aside, I want to bring this back to a real hometown situation. One of my communities, it's a small community, it sits at the crossroads of an agricultural intersection in southeastern Minnesota. Very tiny little town. Everyone, or I should say every family in that community has cancer. And I want to know why. There's one family that doesn't have cancer, and that's the new young couple that just moved to town a few years ago, bought an old store, and is trying to restore the old mercantile. They've brought to my attention that every single family in that community has cancer. And I want to know why.
Just like with the frogs, I think any disease is complicated. And let me be clear, I have not said here that atrazine is the sole cause of all amphibian declines. But atrazine and other pesticides, I firmly believe the data show, are contributing. In that same way, I think even more so with humans, it's going to be very difficult to pinpoint, unless you're living on a Superfund site, that is the thing that gave me cancer. But when you have evidence, like the evidence we have for atrazine and some other pesticides. Atrazine just happens to be the one that I work on, and it happens to be the most ubiquitous one, and it happens to be the most active one that I've worked on, that I've encountered. When you have that evidence, I don't think you can continue to deny that it doesn't contribute, and other things in that environment as well, to those problems.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Doctor. I've heard your testimony today, and you talk about 40 years of atrazine exposure, and I agree. And I'm a registered nurse, and Senator Sharon is a registered nurse, and many of us have histories where we can understand that coming to a single diagnosis and then trying to understand the causative factors, you know, is very difficult and very complex. But if you're ever interested in a living laboratory, I think I can offer you a few suggestions. This is a community that has been exposed to lots of different agricultural chemicals and who knows what else. And that's why I'm interested in this bill, because it gives us a starting point to begin at least to measure levels of chemicals in the water that they're drinking. They're all on wells. What are they being exposed to, either through the air or through the soil or through the water systems? And unless we start measuring, however are we going to get us to a solution where I can find out why everyone in Newburgh has cancer?
This brings up another issue in current state of things now. As I'm sure you know, Paul Watzka's case, even if it's measured, can you get the information? As you know, and what's happened to your right to know bill,
right.
Even if somebody knows, can you get the information to start figuring that out? And that's why I think Minnesota's moving in a very positive direction, and I'm very happy to come here anytime I can to help it continue to move in that direction. Nothing else, for selfish reasons, that I'm thinking about my and where I want my children to grow up.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hayes, Senator Hahn said he wasn't a scientist, and he's probably light years ahead of me, so I'm obviously not a scientist. There's several things that I wrote notes about what you said, but I probably can't possibly get to them all. But one of the things you mentioned, and basically it's just a comment, is that the EPA wants to, if in lay language, kind of start from scratch. Well, I guess just a comment, that's what I'd like a government agency to do. I don't think they should begin studies from a biased perspective. I think they should start from scratch and do the work from an unbiased perspective. So in some ways, I appreciate the fact that they want to be unbiased in the beginning and do the work in controlled circumstances. I'm just a comment. I don't need long answers. I'm just...
I mean, I can be brief. If they want to do it from an unbiased perspective, then the EPA and Syngenta, the registrant, shouldn't be doing the work together.
The other thing that I tend to look at is life, because that's my teacher. I grew up on a farm, a dairy farm to be specific, although we had several other types of animals too, and I guess I still consider myself a farm girl at heart. My father used atrazine. At the time, it was basically the only killer that he had other than the cultivator, and that took a lot of work and a lot of time and uprooted some good plants too. So we did use atrazine. The application methods back at the beginning of atrazine were certainly not as good or accurate as they are today. So there was more overspray. There was more spraying done when there was wind going on. My brothers are very careful now that the climate conditions are right so that they don't have overspray and that type of thing. And the other thing that occurred and still occurs on those farms is that the cattle, and I'm speaking dairy and beef cattle specifically, got their water from the streams, which were right next to the field. We have far better protections in place with rotational grazing and setbacks from the rivers, all of that type of thing. So we've done some very good things in that way. But the cattle drank directly from the stream, and if they didn't drink from the stream, they drank right from the well, which, let me tell you, you put the cornfield up as close to the house as you could practically because you needed the production that you could get. And so the atrazine was right there by the well. And after 40 years, when I look at dairy and beef cattle in a real-life situation, because you talked about exposure, they're probably the animals that are the most exposed. And you talked about the rat, and yes, we had rats on the farm, and without human intervention, they got to be more, not less. And so these cattle, by your studies or hypothesis or whatever you want to call it, should indeed be having significant problems. But generations of the same cattle have not had those problems. There's not an infertility problem, as you indicated there could be. And the other thing that's noticeably different than what you indicated in the rats or in your studies is that these milk-producing animals, the production is significantly up. It's not decreased, and yet you showed a rat, and the next generation, there was insufficient milk, when the animals that are by far the most exposed have exactly the opposite situation. The milk production from when my dad farmed to when my brother's farm probably at least doubled and probably even tripled. So
that'd be a good question.
The animal that's the most in most intimate contact with atrazine has not had the effects you've had. And the other thing that I don't know, so I hesitate to bring it up, while their fertility rate has not gone down either. You have multiple births, probably more now than before. The other thing is among farm families, you talked about all of these various things, and I don't know that the birth rate, except by choice, which it is basically throughout most places, has decreased by choice, the number of children they're having, but not because of a lack of ability to have children in farm families in particular. So life on the farm doesn't seem to bear out what you're saying. And that's where it's the contact is with atrazine on a firsthand personal basis. The second thing, another thing that you mentioned is that you talked about the stream in California and how in one area of the stream the animals live, and yet when they're moved to another area of the stream where something is different in the water, they die. That's true all over. It's like putting a saltwater fish in a freshwater aquarium. If the elements or the content or whatever the stuff, because I'm not a scientist again, the stuff in the water is different, certain animals can't live in that water. And an example of that just in our own environment, it was not that very many years ago that you would never see a possum in Minnesota. You see possums in Minnesota now frequently. I mean, they're coming almost as much as raccoons dead on the road. We're going to have new jokes about the possum crossing the road. And so animals adapt to their environment over time. And yet dumping an animal in an unfamiliar environment, yes, may indeed kill them.
That's not what we did, though, by the way. I don't want to interrupt, but the animals were in situ, so they were already trying to live in that area. No animals were transplanted in the study.
You said when an animal was taken from downstream, it could not live in the upstream water or something to that nature.
That's not what I said, and that's not what we did. We measured animals that were born upstream or downstream and looked at their ability to grow. And nobody moved any animals in that study. And then we replicated that in the laboratory using that same water. But, well, so I'm sorry if that wasn't clear.
That actually makes it more uncertain to me. I mean, because, yeah, well, anyway. So I just think, from a real-life standpoint, a lot of what you're saying doesn't bear out. That's just real-life standpoint. And secondly, you talked about the farmers, the people that are most exposed to atrazine, the people that are applying it in their families, they're not asking to have it banned. They're not.
With all due respect.
The other thing that you have to take a look at when you talk about farming, I get very defensive about farming, I'll be really honest. When you talk about farming, you got to have to talk about all aspects of farming. Essentially, there's like three different types of farming. You have the family farm where you have a smaller herd of cattle. You have a little smaller acreage. And that family farm fills a very important role in Minnesota and across the country in what they do for their family and in what they do for the rest of the community, what they raise their own family's food, et cetera, and they feed other people as well. Then you can take the organic farm. And the organic farm has another very special place that it fills, a very special niche. Those that have allergies oftentimes choose organic for purpose of controlling allergies. In other family cases, it's just simply a choice to eat organic or to do that type of natural thing, which is great. It's another role that's filled. Then you take the large farmer, and they fill another role too. They feed many, many people with what they produce. But the point is that if we take, they're not asking this to be done, even though they're the most directly affected. And if we just take and simply start biting the hands that are feeding us, maybe they won't care to feed us anymore.
Let me give you.
You should think about that.
Let me give you another perspective. One, I can't comment on the cow unless I see the data, unless I know what they're exposed to. And the rat data weren't mine, by the way. They were produced by Center for Disease Control, National Institutes of Health, Environmental Protection Agency laboratories. And my training teaches me that if we get all these adverse effects being shown in these animals that represent us, then they can't be all wrong or random. So those weren't my data. That was my review of this federal government's experts on in these areas. My response to the farmers not asking for it to be taken away, my father sanded asbestos all of his life, put down floor cover. All of his uncles died, who taught him to trade, died of asbestos poisoning. He never asked for the asbestos to be taken away. That was his job, and that's what he did. And I would argue that Mexican migrant farm workers 2,400 parts per billion atrazine in their urine, they're not going to ask to have it taken away. The people where I work and I drive through and I see these poor guys picking in the fields, many who might not even be documented? Of course they're not going to ask. The factory workers with the 8.44 prostate cancer, unskilled workers who can't get a job upstairs in the factory, they're not going to ask for it to be taken away. That's their job. The people in Louisiana at the end of the Mississippi River where we're dumping all of this, who are living in poverty, some of them in the same tenements that slaves lived in back in the day, they don't have a voice to ask for it to be taken away. The children, after Katrina, which used to go to Tulane University to get their treatments, children with childhood cancers, after Katrina, they had to go to Texas from the same community where the Syngenta plant is. Somebody finally asked, how are you getting all the way to Houston to get your treatments now? They said, we carpool. The children living in that area, what they call Cancer Alley, there's enough children with rare childhood cancers that they can carpool. They have no voice to have it taken away. The people who are most likely exposed on the big farms, the big owners, like the places we work in Nebraska and Iowa, the people who are actually out in those fields, they have no voice to ask for it to be taken away. And when you look at Hispanic Americans, they have lower incidences of most of the cancers than Caucasian Americans, unless they work in the agricultural industry. And they don't have a voice for that. And I don't want my daughter and her daughter exposed to that, or yours, or anybody else that's in this room. That's just how my belief system works. So if we can replace it, and if we can put health first, I may not convince you. Some people I can talk all day and not convince. But hopefully we can convince enough that we put health first and our real future first.
Mr. Chair.
But I thank you for your comments.
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, I did neglect to mention one thing. We talk about the dangers of atrazine and the dangers of many things, and we try to curtail the use of certain things and everything, but we seem to forget that statistically we're living longer all the time. When you talk about pensions, you always have to talk about mortality studies because people are living longer. They're not living shorter lives. And the quality of our life is pretty good.
Can be better.
Senator Higgins had a question as well, and then I'd like to move on because we want both Mr. Watzka and the department to have time to testify as well.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chair, just a comment to Senator Wergens. I think what they're telling us is that our generation isn't as healthy as the previous generations. We may be living longer, but we're not as healthy as they were. And Dr. Hayes, I grew up on a farm in Iowa. And if there was a chemical that could save my dad some time, some effort, he loved it. And he put them all on our farm, by gosh. And in our county, you could bring, you've probably heard me tell this story before, you could bring a pint jar of water from your farm to the county fair, put your name and address on it, and they'd test it for free. And you'd get this little postcard back saying, you have great water, you know, or whatever. And we always got the you have great water postcards back. One year we got the postcard saying, don't drink this water. And that was really scary for my family. You know, it was always the best water around. It tasted the best. It was cold. It was wonderful. It was our water. What the heck? And so for years, we hauled water onto the farm to drink because, you know, the combination of the feedlot and the chemicals and where our house was situated on that farm put them all together in the same place, and we could no longer drink the water. Just wanted to let you know.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hayes. And there may be more questions later for you or Syngenta or whomever, but thank you for coming. Mr. Watzka. Paul Watzka is a hydrologist who was formerly with Department of Agriculture and PCA. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wergen.
If I may, hearing Dr. Hayes' testimony was very interesting, and I was very open to that. However, I must say before this witness even starts that I have a great deal of concerns with this gentleman testifying before the committee today. it is my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there is an open and pending lawsuit at this point in time, which essentially ties the hands of those that may have conflicting information to what Mr. Watzka is going to give. And as a Senate committee, I find it disconcerting that the Syngentas and the EPAs were not invited to give testimony in what may have been, I don't know, but what may have been an opposing point of view to Dr. Hayes. But I can live with that because they can come at a later date or something like that. However, this is an entirely different situation. We have here an employee that's been released from employment.
Let me interrupt, Senator Wergen. We're not going to have his testimony on why he was fired. We are simply having his testimony on levels of atrazine here. I told him he's welcome to tell us that he was fired, but he can't comment on it either. His attorney doesn't want him to talk about it, nor does the state agencies want to talk about it. So we're not going to get into any of that. We're talking his testimony. Dr. Hayes was talking about the risks of atrazine. Mr. Watzka is talking about levels of atrazine in groundwater, in surface water particularly.
Mr. Chair, I still would suggest that we have someone here that has an open and pending lawsuit with the state of Minnesota and one of its agencies. And it seems very inappropriate when, irregardless of what's said during testimony, it cannot be refuted. And there are, there are public documents that suggest that this is an inappropriate thing to do at this point in time.
I haven't seen any documents that say this is inappropriate, but just so you understand the history of this.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator Wergen.
I'm sorry. I'm going to read from a public document that indicates why this may be inappropriate.
Okay.
It's from the Department of Employee Relations, and it cites the reasons for the termination of this employee. And one of the reasons is, I'm quoting, "You removed numerous hard copies of Minnesota Department of Agriculture's data analysis sheets and field logs books from the department Rochester office prior to your separation from the department. So we're going to hear testimony about things that may have been deleted from a hard drive by someone that was an employee for the state of Minnesota. That seems rather inappropriate." It goes on to say, "You intentionally deleted thousands of critical data files from your Minnesota Department of Agriculture computer. And so we're going to hear testimony from someone that these are allegations that are out there and may well be speaking to the things that he personally may well have erased from a hard drive. That's a large concern for me."
Senator Marty, I'm going to ask that you not
have this person testify because I think it's wrong.
Okay. Let me respond to that then, okay? First of all, the history of how Mr. Watzka first came. I had never met him. I first met him this morning. I've talked to him on the phone a couple of times. Representative Chumper, who's sitting in on the hearing, had a bill. He's house author of a couple of my bills related to this issue. And he had read something that Mr. Watzka had he was quoted in the DNR, the Volunteer, the little magazine they put out. Representative Chumper saw that and asked if he could come to testify in the House committee there. Mr. Watzka at that time asked, as he's required to do, asked his supervisors if he can testify. He gave them a copy of his testimony, so it was not anything secret. And they told him, "No, you're not allowed to testify. Instead, we'll have somebody from the Department of Agriculture," where you had collected the data and so on. So they had the testimony he had. There was no lawsuit at the time. He hadn't been fired at the time. And so he is going to testify strictly on the issue of levels of atrazine in the groundwater, in the surface water, excuse me, and the issue related to that. This is not going – what I find offensive is that the Commissioner of Employee Relations is going there and writing out what all the issues are because there is a lawsuit, as you're saying.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is public court document. This is not confidential data. It's available to the public at any for
anyone. I'm sure Mr. Watzka could tell us all kinds of things that would be public data, too, if he says them. But I'm just telling you that I don't think it's appropriate for him to get into all the details of that, nor is it appropriate for the Department of Employee Relations to get into it.
Mr. Chair, I did not get this from the Department of Employee Relations.
Well, I'm saying that they're putting it out there. I thought you said it was from them.
No, I did not.
Okay. In any case, I will ask Mr. Watzka not to talk about his termination or anything related to that. Just talk about the issue of levels of atrazine, the issues of pesticides in the – you're a hydrologist in the waters.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make one additional comment. I had not heard the part all of what you said about the Mr. Watzka being able to testify in front of another committee, but what you said actually – makes sense to me in that if I understand correctly, Mr. Watzka was no longer at the Department of Agriculture when he was asked to testify. And so to testify on work time for a department that he's no longer in doesn't make sense. He could have personally taken a day of vacation and come and testified as a committee, as any citizen would have had to do. However, to come and testify about an apartment that he formerly worked in, which I understand he left on his own volition. Mm-hmm. So it seems he could have taken some vacation and come and testified as an individual citizen.
I know a lot of state employees who are not allowed to talk to legislators. They're not allowed to talk to the media. I know at least one who's been fired for putting out work like this, and Mr. Watzka comes here and is asked to testify, tells his superiors, doesn't even testify, and he's gone a few weeks later. What do you know? I'm just saying that I think it's really troubling that state employees are discouraged from testifying here, even on their own time. And he is a hydrologist who was working for the Department of Agriculture. He moved to the Pollution Control Agency, still is a hydrologist, still working in similar issues. Representative Chumper, as you have the opportunity to call witnesses for your bills as well, Representative Chumper heard his testimony, read a story or something he was quoted in the DNR publication, and said, I'd like this guy to come testify. Representative Chumper got the message back from him that he couldn't testify. He assumed the guy was unavailable, and that was it. But my point is the department didn't present that testimony, even though they knew what he was going to present. When he was told he couldn't come because he's not the best one to speak for the department, I don't think he was planning to speak for the department. I think he was planning to tell what the representative asked him for.
Well, Mr. Chair, then my point is actually well taken. He could have taken a day of vacation and come anyway. As a county commissioner, when I served in that capacity, the county had a formal policy that employees, if they were going to testify, that it was not, if it was not something that was representative of the county, you might say, that they could come on a day of their own time and come and testify. And it is indeed true that no one can be prevented from coming to testify as an individual citizen.
That's what their right is. They may get fired for it. They may get fired for it, but it's their right to. I know.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest through the grievance processes and stuff we had, they would have an opportunity to refute that.
That would be nice.
Mr. Chairman, just
Senator Hand, then let's go with this.
Sorry, I wanted just to comment on the point Senator Worgen is making. I think she makes a valid point. And my understanding is part of the debate is that Mr. Watzka is wanting to testify or has testified or has the opinion that atrazine is a problem and that he was prevented from testifying because the department didn't want him to present this damaging to their position, presumably, information about atrazine. And so part of this, I think, impinges on the veracity of this testimony about the about atrazine. If he was fired because he was going to present data that the department didn't want them to know about or didn't want to be exposed publicly, if that's part of the argument that's being constructed here, then I think it's pertinent to say, shouldn't we know the facts about his termination? And did it have anything to do with this testimony? And from what I can tell from the public documents that Senator Worgen refers to, it had nothing to do with it. And so if that's part of what is being constructed here, is this to continue on the sort of conspiracy level that we were talking about the previous witness, that there's some attempt to hide facts from the public and to present something as benign that is, in fact, you know, very, very dangerous. And if this is a part of that, then I think it does speak to the wisdom of having a person who's involved in a lawsuit on that very issue before this committee when we don't have the opportunity to know what the grounds of termination were about, whether it had anything to do with atrazine at all. And we should know that.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, the gentleman hasn't said a word yet. And we've already had people on our committee who are undermining his testimony. I think most of us probably thought we were going to be done at 3. It's after 3. Can we just have the testimony on this single sole issue at which this gentleman was asked to come and speak to our committee so that we can get the scientific data that I think is the whole point of this committee?
In fairness to Mr. Watzka, I think that's appropriate because I think he's being tried here by all the accusations that everybody's reading without him having a chance to respond, and he's not going to respond to it. I talked with him about this issue ahead of time, and he said his attorney doesn't want him to comment on it at all. So I think it's appropriate he has a chance to speak about the issue that he has been doing research on over many years, and I would appreciate if you go ahead. So please identify yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, may I ask one question?
Go ahead, Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Mr. Watzka is going to testify, not that it would be necessary at a later point in the hearing, but would Mr. Watzka be willing to sign a release of information so that the department could also testify if they disagree with the information that's given?
I don't think he should be testifying at all about anything related to employee relations. He's not going to testify about it. If he does, we can talk with him about this and having the department come in. But it sounds to me like the department's saying a whole lot of stuff about him anyway. If I were him, I'd be feeling like I ought to have a right to respond, but I would urge you to not get into that and just stick with the testimony on the atrazine as you were planning to.
Senator Marty, committee members, I am happy to be here. I have provided you a list of resources that my testimony is going to be based on. And in my testimony, I will speak about the knowledge of pesticides in the waters of the state that I obtained over 16 years of employment with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture as a hydrologist. I will cite two examples of how current pesticide regulatory schemes have not worked to protect the state's waters, rivers, and aquifers from pesticide contamination. And finally, I will point out where we are lacking a significant knowledge for the protection of human health, namely pesticide contamination of private drinking water wells, which has been a topic here this afternoon, and suggest a regulatory scheme for correcting this situation. As a background, I came up here today from southeastern Minnesota. I recognize some familiar faces. I was born, however, in the land of Lindbergh, Little Falls, Minnesota. I'm a lifelong resident of Minnesota and received my civil engineering degree from the University of Minnesota. After graduation, I worked for the Metropolitan Council, the Hennepin Conservation District, analyzing water and water quality problems in the metropolitan area. In 1990, I began working for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Atrazine is a widely used herbicide primarily applied on corn, between 1.5 and 3 million pounds. Are applied annually in Minnesota, according to the Agricultural Statistical Service. It is by far the most commonly detected pesticide in our state's waters. Statewide sampling of rivers that I conducted in cooperation with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency during the summers of 1991 through 1993, atrazine along with alichlor were the most frequently detected pesticides. During the period 1991 through 1994, in cooperation with researchers from the University of Minnesota, we performed studies to look at pesticides in rainfall. Atrazine was consistently detected in the vast majority of samples at stations across the state. Between 1992 and 1995, in cooperation with staff from the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, we examined pesticides and urban runoff from a small watershed in Lake Harriet. Again, atrazine was detected frequently in urban runoff going into Lake Harriet, even though it is not used in the watershed and was detected in the lake itself. In that study, we confirmed that the source of atrazine to the Lake Harriet watershed was rainfall, most likely applied on cornfields many miles away. Finally, at surface water stations in southern Minnesota between 1991 and 1999, where the most in-depth sampling took place, atrazine was detected throughout the year, with the highest concentrations occurring shortly after it was applied in late spring and early summer. This early work gave policymakers at MDA and the study cooperators insight into how atrazine gets into the waters of the state and how frequently occurs and in what magnitudes. Beginning in 2000, I began to see an increasing trend in concentrations of atrazine in storm runoff at a number of sites. By the fall of 2000, after seeing this trend continued, I detailed a memo of my concerns to my supervisors. I did not receive a response, nor was I apprised of any action MDA policymakers would take. The trend of increasing concentrations continued through 2004. To summarize atrazine's behavior, atrazine is in our rain. It is in our trout streams, in our urban runoff from our largest metropolitan areas. It is in cold, clear springs, in our muddiest rivers. It is in our aquifers used for drinking water and lakes used for recreation. It is detected in streams in the dead of winter, many months after it was applied. Atrazine's concentrations occur, the highest atrazine concentrations occur in late spring and early summer in storm runoff. It has been omnipresent in our state's waters for many years. With respect to the endocrine disruption threshold mentioned by Dr. Hayes of 0.1 micrograms per liter, based on the work that I described to you, nearly every stream in southern Minnesota would have concentrations above this level for a number of months in a given year. For example, in the middle branch of the Whitewater River, a well-known trout stream, average annual base flow levels of atrazine are 0.3 to 0.4 parts per billion, 3 to 4 times higher than this threshold. Accordingly, I believe there would be far-reaching implications for improving the aquatic health of our water resources if this bill would be passed. But because of the persistent nature of atrazine and how long it has been used to kill weeds, changes in concentration would come slowly and may take years to disappear. Next, I'd like to describe two examples where the current pesticide regulatory scheme has failed to protect our water resources and citizens. The following quotation is from a report prepared for the LCMR by the Departments of Health and Agriculture in 1988. It states, I quote, "The karst region is located in southeastern Minnesota and is characterized by disappearing streams, springs, sinkholes, and fractured limestone bedrock. Karst aquifers feature cracks and crevices in the bedrock that allow rapid water movement. Variable depths of lust-derived, silt-textured soils overlie fractured bedrock. These conditions can result in rapid transport of surface water containing dissolved or soil-bound pesticides into groundwater." This paragraph describes the close, intimate connection between ground and surface water in southeastern Minnesota, and the direct connection between land use and management and the quality of our water resources. The land, hydrology, and water quality of this region needs to be looked at as one connected system. Since 1992, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture has been promoting voluntary best management practices and label changes for atrazine to protect groundwater and surface water in southeast Minnesota. But is this effort working? Objective criteria for evaluating this would be, one, is the amount of atrazine being applied decreasing? Two, is there less atrazine in the water? Based on MDA's atrazine use data, including a report done in 2006 that is yet to be released by MDA detailing higher atrazine use in the Whitewater watershed, a greater amount of atrazine is being used in southeastern Minnesota than anywhere else in the state, and a greater percentage of corn acres, upwards of 90 to 95% in southeastern Minnesota, get atrazine, higher than anywhere else in the state. Second, based on the water quality data from streams in southeastern Minnesota, there has been a significant increase in the amount of atrazine in these streams. The highest concentrations of pesticides seen in streams in Minnesota occurred in 2004. So the question I pose, after 15 years of MDA promoting these BMPs and label changes, how do we have the highest amount of atrazine being used resulting in the highest concentration in streams in the part of the state that is the most vulnerable to pollution from using this herbicide. I would suggest that these efforts to reduce and carefully use atrazine are in fact not being promoted or followed, and that the mandatory label requirements are not being enforced. MDA is required to promote these BMPs and track their adoption rates and enforce label requirements. There are a number of mandatory setback requirements for atrazine, including a 50-foot setback from sinkholes, as well as a 66-foot setback from perennial streams. Does anyone know if these setback requirements are being followed? For example, how many of the estimated 15,000 sinkholes in southeast Minnesota have atrazine applied within the 50-foot setback requirement? In addition, the legislative auditor in his 2006 report on pesticide regulation stated in his list of recommendations to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the effectiveness of these BMPs are not known and need to be immediately verified, especially, I would suggest, to those applicable to this very vulnerable part of the state. Acetachlor regulation is the second example I would like to give to demonstrate that the Minnesota Department of Agriculture is not doing its job to protect the waters of the state from pesticide contamination. Acetachlor, another herbicide, was first registered for use in the United States and in Minnesota in 1994. Since 1995, 3 to 4 million pounds of acetachlor have been applied annually to Minnesota's corn crop. The MDA started monitoring for it in waters of the state in 1995. Once applied, it has been well documented that acetachlor moves to rivers and streams through tile lines, overland flow, and in rainfall. In 1995, it was detected in urban runoff, running into Lake Harriet in South Minneapolis at a level of 0.82 parts per billion, or higher than the water quality criterion of 0.79. In 1999, it was measured in two separate tile lines flowing into designated trout streams at 30 to 40 times the water quality criteria. Finally, in 2007, the MPCA promulgated a water quality standard for acetachlor. This is only the first step to cleaning up our waters that have been polluted for acetachlor. This occurred 14 years after acetachlor was first registered for use in the state and after over a decade of documenting that it moves from fields where it is applied to rivers and streams at high concentrations. The divided responsibilities between various state agencies allow for this delay. One state agency escapes its responsibility while another state agency performs its part of the task. Why does it take 14 years to develop a water quality standard to begin to protect every lake, stream, and river in Minnesota from pesticide contamination? We do know that during those 14 years, over 40 million pounds of acetachlor were sold and applied to Minnesota's cropland. Minnesotans deserve better and a more timely response to new sources of pollution to their water resources. Individuals that are familiar with pesticides and water quality regulation processes in the state know that it is confusing and tedious. Earlier this year, a report was written by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to address the need for an environmental worksheet for the registration of atrazine. In the report, MDA states, detections of atrazine are common at MDA monitoring sites but have not violated water quality standards. This statement directly contradicts the MPCA's 2006 assessment documentation, which showed there's a violation of the human health standard and a violation of the aquatic toxicity standard. Again, you have to ask, who is MDA protecting by refusing to acknowledge the problems with atrazine? For a regulatory process that works, we need to go no farther than the state of Wisconsin that currently prohibits atrazine on 1.2 million acres. It uses private drinking water wells to evaluate concentrations of atrazine plus its three metabolites. In Minnesota, we know very little about what pesticides owners of private drinking wells are drinking. The reason is very simple. nobody tests. In my 16 years working in southern Minnesota collecting pesticide samples, I only sampled a dozen private drinking water wells. Common questions that would come up during public meetings on water quality in southeast Minnesota are, what pesticides are in our drinking water, and how can I get my well tested for pesticides? We need to know what pesticides are in drinking water from private wells. We also need an easy procedure for private well owners to get their wells tested. This is especially important gap in our knowledge of human health in southeast Minnesota because, again, it is particularly sensitive to water pollution. Nearly all of our corn acres receive atrazine and high amounts of nitrogen fertilizer. We know that nitrate and bacteria contamination of wells frequently occurs, yet we know little about pesticides because nobody tests for them. Wisconsin's program works because it is simple enough for the public to participate in and understand. There are 7 steps, and I encourage interested legislators to go to the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade Policy, and Consumer Protection website for details. In closing, I want to emphasize what I talked about extensively in southeast Minnesota to farmers, fishermen, elected officials, and the public. The common goal for all water quality and good land management is to keep pesticides, nutrients, and soil in place. They do the best growing crops and wreak havoc when they enter our aquatic systems. As an owner of a well in southeast Minnesota, I want to personally tell you that I have significant concerns about the water that is being pumped into my kitchen every day. My neighbors and friends who also have their own wells want to believe that the water we are giving our children and grandchildren is not going to make them sick today or harm their health in the future. In the interest of our health and the sake of the health of our posterity, the Minnesota legislature must continue to act to protect our water resources. I thank you for your time and will gladly answer any questions you have concerning my testimony.
Thank you very much, Ms.
Thank you.
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Watzka, you indicated that the data you're talking about, you said you worked for the Department of Ag for 16 years.
Excuse me?
You worked for the Department of Ag for 16 years.
That is correct.
And this is data that you developed while you were there?
This is published data that I've given you the listing of where it has come from.
Senator Wergen, right. You have a sheet in your packet of additional resources that cites the sources he gave us where his numbers are from. It's about 7 items that apparently this information came from those. Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, that's why I was asking where I could get this data other than just
to hear
it.
It's in the
here.
Packets.
There are additional reports, I believe, on the Minnesota Department of Agriculture website that would have all of this data.
Senator Hand, then Representative Jumper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Watzka, just a couple of questions I want to clarify. Is your testimony that the current levels of atrazine found in waters exceeds the standards that we currently have in the state of Minnesota?
Yes, on occasion. They certainly do.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Watzka, I think you mentioned at one point that 3 parts per billion was found in a what is the standard currently in the state? And
the standard differs according to the water resource that we're talking about. For example, if it is drinking water for a municipality, that would be 3 parts per billion. If it is now the law, I guess, that if it is private drinking water, then it would also be 3 parts per billion. But previous to the enactment of the legislation that was passed this spring, it was 20. For surface water, it goes by classification of the stream or river. And so there are different classes. There are classes 1, 2, all the way up to 7. And based on the different classifications, they have different standards.
And so, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Watzka, prior to the legislation that was passed earlier this year, the standard was 20 parts per billion generally?
For private drinking water wells, yes, sir.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Watzka, what is the standard for surface water? And
for the class 2 streams, class 2A, it is 3.4 micrograms per liter. For class 1B, it is 3. And I believe for class, and again, I'm relying on my memory here of a rule that is fairly complex. But the 2B, the 2BD, and the 3s would be 10.
And Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, I'm trying to understand, is what you're testifying to that in your studies you were finding levels of contamination that were in excess of this standard, and then when you called the attention of this to the department, they ignored your memos? Is that
if you would look at the concentration numbers and look at the standard, you would see concentrations approaching 30 parts per billion. So if you just evaluate the two numbers, you would look at that and you'd say, goodness, we're seeing some very high numbers here.
And finally, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Watson, you mentioned in your testimony that there was a Legislative Audit Commission or Legislative Auditor report about pesticide regulation in the Department of Agriculture, and you referenced a finding. And just can you, first of all, help me to locate that finding?
It's on the list of recommendations, and it would be at the very back.
And, Mr. Chairman, I was looking at that, and you mentioned you read something that said that the recommendation was the department should do something with respect to parts per billion, and yet I don't find that language.
No, if I could. The legislative auditor made recommendations that the effectiveness of BMPs are not known and need to be immediately verified.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Watson, where is that found in the document? That's what I'm looking for.
It would be in the list of recommendations.
I don't see that on the list of recommendations, but I guess the thing I would point to in the summary that I have, it says the department has done a good job monitoring the use of agricultural pesticides and their effects on groundwater and surface water, and it does have some question about monitoring of urban use and so forth. But are you saying that their conclusion that the department is doing a good job is not correct?
I am indicating that there are some holes, and I'm indicating that I laid out the very specific requirements, setback requirements, that I don't believe that the legislative auditor addressed. There are setback requirements specific to the atrazine label, 50-foot setback requirements from sinkholes, 66-foot setback from perennial streams. And if you would talk to trout fishermen, they are very concerned because they are obviously familiar with the streams and they do not see those setback requirements. The cornfields are much closer to the streams than 66 feet. We have no information about the setback requirements from sinkholes.
Representative Jumper.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Senator Hahn, I think if you read Section 2 of the OLA report, you will find the criticisms that Mr. Watzka is relating to it. For example, it is talking about the department, it has seldom requested additional information or imposed restrictions on products before registering them, nor has the department developed criteria for when it will review product information in greater detail. And further on, it talks about over the last 15 years, the department has imposed state restrictions on only 3 pesticide products. There's more and more in that section. But, Senator Marty, I did want to pursue a little different line of questions with Mr. Watzka. But before I do that, I wanted to say to Senator Wergen, Senator, I am the author of the House version of this bill. I'm also a farmer. In fact, I'm the only dairy farmer in the legislature, which I've done for over 30 years. And sometime I'd like to have a talk with you about what I believe farmers in this state really want in all kinds of ways. As I tell people, farmers are low-density suburbanites. They want the same things that everyone else in this state does, including clean water and clean air. And so I'd like to have a discussion with you sometime about that. But to my questions to Mr. Watzka, are you familiar with the 1989 Groundwater Protection Act?
Yes, I am.
I'll have to look at my note here. Is there a term in that act called commonly detected contaminant?
Yes.
Can you explain to us what that means?
It's It's laid out in statute, but basically what it says is that if a chemical is detected due to routine use, not spills, not incidences where, you know, there would be some abnormal behavior, then it's declared common detection.
Is atrazine a commonly detected contaminant, would you say?
Atrazine is officially a commonly detected contaminant, and I believe it has been so since 1992.
And when a contaminant is commonly detected, what is MDA supposed to do under the 1989 Groundwater Protection Act? Could you
They are supposed
that?
To implement voluntary measures. They are supposed to track their adoption rates. They are supposed to look at whether or not that voluntary measure is those voluntary measures are working. And if they're not working, they have to go to, I believe it's called water resource protection requirements, which are mandatory regulations governing the use and applications of that commonly detected pesticide or compound.
And isn't the final step in that is if they can't get it out of that classification of commonly detected, then they're supposed to remove it from the market?
That is correct.
And my final question, it really isn't dependent on levels of concentration that it shows up anyplace, is it? If it's The standard is if it commonly shows up someplace at some level from regular use, correct?
That is correct. That is my understanding. And there was, at one point in time, a very big dispute, and again, about whether or not common detection applies to surface water. Now, you can read the 1996 Common Detection Advisory Committee report. There is some interesting language in there from this advisory committee that, again, was not called for by statute or called for by rule, but really to eliminate surface water within that definition. These were not attorneys or judges or, you know, people well-versed in the law, but this was an advisory committee that basically said common detection does not apply to surface waters. That's not the what the statute reads at all. But that's a whole nother dispute.
And I'd just like to end, Senator Marty, by saying that the 1989 Groundwater Protection Act also requires that drinking water standards be reviewed every 4 years. They were initially set in the 1993 and 94 period, and they've never been reviewed since that time. In fact, that's what the bill that you and I authored this spring is requiring now of the Department of Health to do, only about 12 or so years later than they were supposed to do it. So if that is an indictment of the whole regulatory process in this state as regards to pesticides, I don't know what is, Senator.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Chumperi said that I don't live on a farm or farm. I did not say that my family members don't or my friends. I'm very familiar with it, talk with farmers nearly daily. Senator Marty, I'm sorry, Mr. Watzka, I heard you say that the Minnesota Department of Agriculture doesn't set their own standards for pesticides, et cetera, but we do follow all the EPA standards. Is that not correct?
I mean, it's not. Concerning water quality standards with respect to water, they come from the Department of Health, they come from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and they come from EPA.
Mr. Chair, so Mr. Watzka, we do have standards that we're following. The way you said it before almost sounded like we weren't following any standards. We didn't have any guidelines.
Actually, for the 900 or so compounds, pesticides that are registered for in the state, there are only a couple of handfuls of standards for pesticides in surface waters. I could probably rattle them off for you. Atrazine, acetochlor, we just are promulgating a new one atrazine and aliclor, and we're promulgating a new one for acetochlor, and there's maybe a handful of other pesticides that have surface water standards. We have probably a dozen pesticides that we see commonly in surface waters that we have no standards for.
no standards have been developed. And some of the other standards, I would argue, the 3 parts per billion for atrazine in drinking water is 30 times the concentration that Dr. Hayes is showing having the impact on amphibians, and 30 times. So it's a question, are those standards good enough? And in his point is that a lot of these chemicals we don't have any standards for.
Acetachlor is a good example. We used it for 14 years, Senator, before we had a promulgated standard.
Mr. Chair, we
currently do not even have a drinking water standard for acetachlor. That is still in the works.
Mr. Chair, is that the health department that's supposed to make those, the ag department, the WHO department?
Again, it depends on the water resource you're talking about. Generally speaking, the health department is groundwater. They promulgate the HRLs that would govern private drinking water wells. The MPCA will promulgate standards governing surface waters, rivers, streams, and lakes.
Sir Erickson Ropes, then we'll get the Department of Agriculture, and then we're running along. So go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Marty, and Mr. Watka, thank you for being here. Perhaps this is a question for you, or perhaps just it's just a really naive question for the committee. I was raised in a small town, not on the farm, but I'm first generation of my family off the farm. Everybody else is farmers. I was raised in the city, but my mom still taught us when we were kids growing up, we'd go out camping, that she always tried to leave the world a better place. You know, we go out camping, we also had to go around and pick up all sorts of litter before we left the campground and, you know, not throw things in the water and things like that. And, you know, I think part of this is not only cultural, but, you know, some people might say spiritual in terms of trying to take care of the creation that we're given to have charge over. I don't understand, when we're talking about drinking water standards and that sort of thing, why it isn't zero? I mean, who is it that wants poisons in our water? And who is it that thinks it's okay to have cancer-producing toxins in the water? And who thinks it's okay or it's not a problem if there's a certain level of an endocrine disrupting chemical out there? I mean, I don't even want to bathe in that stuff, much less drink it. When did it get okay that we're talking about, well, the level in this stream should be this, or the level in the municipal drinking water should be this, but if it's your private well, it could be a lot higher. Why isn't it zero? When did we, as a community and a state and a nation decide that poison in our drinking water is just fine?
Senator, I'm an engineer. That's my background. Engineers are trained to solve problems. That's what we do. If you would be monitoring the state's waters and hundreds of samples would be taken, and in nearly every one of those samples, you would see a certain compound, and you would be sampling rainfall, you'd be sampling springs, you'd be sampling wells, you'd be sampling streams of all sizes, shapes, from across the state. You would eventually conclude what I did, was that this is a problem, and this needs to be addressed, and you would try your hardest to bring it to the attention of policymakers.
On that note, thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate your coming and willingness to speak out on this. Thank you very much. We have Dan Stoddard from the Department of Agriculture finally. And Senator Higgins, for the committee was actually scheduled from 1 to 4, but the computer system only lets us tell the starting time of committee, so we're trying to make sure that's correct.
I'm here for the duration, so that's
it's good. It's almost done.
I have obligations. I already blew off a day of work.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair. Chair, my name is Dan Stoddard. I'm Assistant Director for Environmental Programs in the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division of the Minnesota Department of Ag.
Mr. Goddard, could you bring the microphone closer to you, please?
Excuse me, Mr. Stoddard.
Stoddard, sorry.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I have only a short statement, and then I assume there'd be some questions, so we'll be available for programmatic questions. The Department of Ag is very concerned about atrazine in the surface and groundwater of Minnesota. Atrazine is frequently detected at low levels in groundwater, generally well below the health standard, in areas with vulnerable aquifers and row crop agriculture. Atrazine is also frequently detected in surface waters and agricultural areas, especially following spring storms. If it rains soon after atrazine is applied in the spring, it can result in a flushing effect of atrazine coming off the land surface. Atrazine can be found at high levels relative to the standard in surface waters. However, there are seldom violations of the standard because a violation requires that the average concentration exceed the standard over a four-day period. Currently, there are no surface water bodies that are impaired due to atrazine in Minnesota. However, based on historical monitoring data, we are concerned about the potential for elevated levels of atrazine in runoff if there is a significant rain soon after application in the spring, particularly in southeast Minnesota. We have developed and are promoting best management practices for atrazine to protect both surface and groundwater. In addition, atrazine application rates have dropped significantly since the late 1980s and early 1990s. Monitoring data indicates that the concentration of atrazine in groundwater is dropping. In 2005 and 2006, the concentration of atrazine in surface waters was lower than in previous years, but that may be caused in part by relatively little rainfall during the spring in 2005 and 6. We continue to monitor in cooperation with the MPCA and other cooperators to evaluate long-term trends in water quality. The Department of Agriculture does not develop, nor do we have the technical expertise to develop, environmental or health standards. These standards are developed by the Department of Health and the Pollution Control Agency and are important for evaluating the relative risk posed by any contaminants. We submit our monitoring data to these agencies for their review and work closely with them in support of their efforts to establish standards. In conclusion, we believe that the best management practices for atrazine are appropriate, and we are actively promoting them with many different groups. There is widespread awareness and support in the agricultural community for the best management practices. We are committed to moving forward and taking action as necessary to address the environmental concerns from atrazine. And with that, I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Were you going to just answer questions? Okay. Questions from members of the committee. Representative Gardner.
Thanks for letting me crash your party. Senator, I'm Representative Gardner from the House, chairing a subcommittee on drinking water. My wife used to help register pesticides, so I know a little bit of how that works a little bit. But let me get further down in the decision-making chart here. If we all assume it's an issue and a ban was considered, what are farmers in those areas that are not using the farmers in Wisconsin that aren't spraying it, I think, on 1.2 million acres in Switzerland and other places in Europe, what are they using as a substitute for atrazine? And is that product registered here in Minnesota? I'm just looking to see what the substitutes would be, and is it more costly? Is it less effective? And
Mr. Chair and members, almost everything that's been discussed today is complicated. I think people are looking for simple answers, and I don't think you're going to find a simple answer for most of these things. And to go into any single question is going to take some time. What you asked about alternatives is a very significant question with all pesticides. Farmers have weed problems, and they're going to have to use something to address those weeds. So if, let's say, atrazine is banned, then there will need to be another product, or they'll maybe have to use some kind of mechanical approach, which in turn could result in increased sediment runoff, increased phosphorus and nitrogen rates. I'm not sure that there's any agricultural practice that's not going to have some impact on the environment, just as there is no practice for anything, basically, where humans are involved, that's not going to have some impact on the environment. And so we don't intend to or try to oversimplify these things. In Europe, where atrazine is not allowed to be used, our understanding is that it's not allowed because of a policy, not based on the health risk, but there's a policy that if there is a risk of a particular ag chemical being greater than 1/10 of a part per billion in groundwater, regardless of health risk, they don't allow it to be used. But they don't have as much corn in Europe as much of America's do. And they also do have other similar products that are registered for use that we don't have in Minnesota.
Representative Chumper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stoddard, I actually pursued this in working on my legislation this spring, what alternatives there were to atrazine, and I actually have an extension bulletin in my office from Ohio Extension that specifically lists 10 alternatives to atrazine that in this extension bulletin are described as cost-effective alternatives to atrazine. And I'll make sure that you get a copy of that so you can see that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Chumper, we're not saying there's not alternatives. There are always alternatives.
Good.
But I guess the point we're trying to make is one needs to be cautious about unintended consequences. Just because there's an alternative does not mean it's a better alternative. It doesn't mean it's worse either. You need to look at the details. Weed science is fairly challenging. Managing weeds isn't simple. You need to look at the weed problem, then consider whether or not a particular product suite is going to work on your farm, your operation. So we're not saying there's not alternatives. There are. But what we're saying is there might not be a simple answer. It just might not be that straightforward.
I have to tell you that the last herbicide I used in my farm was atrazine in 1980, so I'm familiar with atrazine. I do have a couple other questions, Senator Marty. Mr. Stoddard, you described best management practices. Could you detail those? I'm curious what the best management practices are that you're advising people to use to minimize the adverse effects of atrazine.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Representative Chumper. I'm not going to be able to go through all of them,
well,
but
some of
I think
them.
The best management practices for atrazine and also the ones that have been developed for other herbicides, they're divided into two groups. We have generic ones that apply to all herbicides, and then we have product-specific ones for the five herbicide active ingredients that we have determined formally are commonly detected in groundwater. So we've got two sets. They're intended to be used together. Examples, I also believe that they have been very well received. We've got very high comments from both the ag community and environmental community on these BMPs, so I think they're very practical, real world. But examples would include things like limiting atrazine use to 8 pounds, 0.8 pounds, excuse me, per acre in vulnerable areas in southeast Minnesota. There's one exception for a certain kind of finer textured soil. Reduced rates, evaluating reduced rates to see whether or not you can get by with a lower rate. Setback distances from tile lines and from surface water bodies, rotating chemistries, trying to reduce the amount of atrazine or whatever the product is by using different products. Those are the kinds of examples of the best management practices that the department has.
Senator, Mr. Stoddard, are you familiar with the 1989 Groundwater Act?
I am, sir.
Do you think the department is fulfilling the letter of the law in regards to enforcing that, specifically the part that relates to commonly detected contaminants and the process of going from voluntary best management practices to mandatory best management practices and then ultimately to removing a product if it isn't taken care of with the first two options?
Mr. Chair, Representative Chumper, we developed a guidance manual, a pesticide management plan for how the state of Minnesota is going to respond to pesticides in surface waters of the state. And we have revised it several times. The revision process was a public process. We went through comments. And part of that, we were very careful to make sure that we are consistent with the Groundwater Protection Act. We believe that we are very closely following the instructions in that act. The Groundwater Protection Act does outline a process for going to regulation, but it directs that we use a voluntary approach first, and only if the voluntary BMPs are proven ineffective can we consider regulations, and then the regulations should be based on the BMPs. So we've spent a lot of time trying to make sure that our guidance and the process that we followed is consistent with that act.
Do you have any mandatory BMPs right now? That you're enforcing?
A mandatory BMP would not. The BMPs are by definition voluntary, so we do not have mandatory BMPs. There are label restrictions on atrazine. There are not. There's a number of label restrictions on many other products, but the ones for atrazine are much more strict than other products.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Stoddard, thank you. And I didn't ask this question earlier. I don't know if it's a question for yourself. I'm sure you know the answer to this, but I could have asked the other gentleman as well. But Is atrazine persistent in the environment?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, it is.
Okay, and do you know how long it stays around? Because I know some chemicals, wash through or break down and don't present too much of a problem. But tell me about atrazine.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is one of the issues with atrazine. It is relatively persistent in the environment. The amount of time that it takes to break down is going to depend on the geochemical setting, but it is normally months before it's going to break down into a degradate, and then the degradates are persistent also. We frequently find the degradates at higher concentrations than the parent in groundwater.
Okay, so you're saying that in under a year it breaks down from the chemical we know as atrazine to something else?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not sure the exact time. It is on the order of months, but it varies depending upon the setting, the temperature,
right,
the biologics in the ground.
Sure.
It's not that straightforward.
Okay. Mr. Chair, one other question. One thing that I hear in talking to farm families back in my district, and I know many of them, and they're concerned about the environment, and these are good people, and everybody tends to point their finger at farmers whenever we talk about farm chemicals. But I know a lot of them are doing a really good job trying to be responsible. One of the things that they ask me, and I don't know, is it possible that some of the atrazine levels we're looking at today and measuring have been applied many years in advance?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, I think that's likely. It depends on the well construction, on how deep the well is, and whether product is being applied nearby. One of the greatest sources of contamination to drinking water wells is a poorly constructed well, where essentially they're drinking surface water that goes down a well casing. We do sample. We have done some sampling of wells. The Department of Health samples city wells on a routine basis. We also have a monitoring system that's set up where we monitor specially constructed monitoring wells that are on the edge of farm fields that are in the very, very shallow groundwater. So it's the worst case possible scenario. And we have a considerable amount of data on what you're likely to find in pesticides in groundwater in Minnesota. It's very unlikely in Minnesota to have an exceedance of a health standard for atrazine. But we do frequently find these chemicals in shallow, vulnerable groundwater.
Well, which happens in the part of the state that I'm from, because we do have the karst geography that we're talking about there. And, I'm worried if, even if we make a dramatic change in our application practices or best management practices of atrazine now, that it's still going to be around for a long time. Is there any discussion about a plan to decontaminate the wells or the soil? Or if it's persistent, even if we make a change today, it's going to be a problem that's going to be around for a long time.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm a groundwater hydrologist by training, and that is one of the challenges with groundwater is if you get contamination in groundwater, it does tend to be persistent. It will eventually disperse and degrade, but it takes time. And so ideally, you want to do your best to prevent that contamination. And I think agricultural groups, everyone are going to agree that prevention is the goal, and that is the cornerstone of our pesticide management plan.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Erickson-Ropes, I really want to thank you because our farmers are great people, and they do the best they can for the environment. And, yes, they do want clean water and all of the things like that. And I think we do too easily vilify them, and I'm sorry to hear that. Senator Marty, maybe I don't know if Mr. Stoddard knows or not. I haven't done it for a few years, but my assumption is that the Department of Health still will test private wells. You can get your water tested through the Department of Health. Is that not true? I used to all the time.
I don't believe they routinely will test private wells. We've got a couple programs going, or did actually. One was nitrate clinics, where we would provide free testing for nitrates. We've also done some pilots with amino assay testing. And then on our website, we have a list of relatively inexpensive private companies that you can go to have your well screened.
Mr. Hayes, did you know the answer to that one about our state agency? Or?
No, but I want to make a comment.
Okay, you're welcome. Come up to the table again. But I do want to say that right during the flood special session a month ago, we, Senator Erickson Ropes and I were present, we were asking the health department if they would do testing of private wells there, and they said no. Because we were concerned because of the flood flow into the well, so they would not there.
Senator Marty, I don't have the bill in front of me right now, but we did put additional money for decontamination of bacteria-related contamination in the wells. But Representative Shumper, maybe you can help me remember, too. I think we do have well testing money in there, and I think it's through Bowser, is it?
Well, that may be. It's only $100,000, and it's only for public water supplies. My understanding is they aren't going to pay for any testing of private wells, and we've had a huge number of private wells that are contaminated. I think there's been 800 private ones tested, and 400 have come back or something. Over 50% have come back high in E. coliforms. And the significance of that is if you've got E. coliform, it may have come from surface water getting into the groundwater aquifers because of this heavy rain. And of course, if that happens, we don't know what else it brought in from the surface waters, like pesticides. So, I mean, we should have had $1 million, and I think that was part of what you were arguing about the day of the session, if I remember correctly.
Yes, Representative Shumper, I believe we were asking for $1 million. We wound up with $100,000. But, you know, there's always February. So.
Dr. Hayes, did you have a comment?
So, yes, I just wanted to respond to clarify for the record. I don't know if the comment was directed at me, but I in no way meant to vilify or blame farmers for anything. I think I work with local farmer groups in California. I have a very close relationship with a separate group of the United Steelworkers Union. In fact, I'm carrying their bag now. And if anything, I think the farmers should be up in arms and working to demand better monitoring and safer limits and safer pesticides from the companies and the agencies that are supposed to be monitoring. So I in no way meant any negative comments towards or any blame on farmers. My blame goes strictly on the government agencies that aren't providing better standards, that aren't providing the information accurately, and on the companies that continue to do this, knowing when Syngenta comes in here and says things like the farmers we serve and know that they've got higher prostate cancer rates in their own factories. That's where my comments were directed, not at farmers at all, absolutely not. So I'm sorry if I gave that impression, absolutely not. I think the farmers are probably the biggest victims in this whole thing, not the accused. So thank you for allowing me to straighten that out.
You can stay there in case there are any more questions. Senator Erickson Ropes, Representative Clark, Representative Shumper, Senator Higgins, and maybe we'll be done then.
Yeah, just a quick comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Hayes. I didn't hear anyone today, you know, suggesting that you were dinging on farmers. But I think that's a general perception out there amongst the farmers that, you know, when we start talking about products that they work with, that they feel that, you know, they're being targeted because they're using the products. And I just wanted to set that aside because I don't think I've heard anyone here say that the person who happens to be using the product is the bad guy. What we're concerned about is the product itself.
Yeah, and sorry.
And then the policy surrounding the product.
And that's why I made the comment about my father and asbestos. It wasn't his. He should have been better informed. There should have been better alternatives and safety for him. And I would argue the same thing for the farmers.
Exactly.
I just heard the comment, let's not vilify, blame the farmers. I want to make sure that that was not my intention, and I hope it didn't come across that way. I apologize if it did. Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Dr. Hayes, I just want to say I didn't hear you say anything negative about farmers. And being a farm kid who got relocated to the city, as most of us do, to get jobs and so on, and being a cancer survivor who understands that my possible source of cancer was from exposure as a child on the farm, this is of great interest to me. And I think the farmer's right to know about these exposures to pesticides and other kinds of things is very, very important. And being the chair of the Public Health Committee in the House and finding out that we have not had for some time that we've not invested in the ability of our people who have private wells to be able to approach the public health agency to get testing is of great concern. We talked about that in the House, and I hope you'll talk about that in the Senate, too. This has all been privatized as part of the movement towards privatization. But my question or my comment is to Mr. Stoddard, is that right?
Yes.
If I understand the discussion that was going on here earlier about the 1989 Groundwater Protection Act, it seems like we wouldn't even need this legislation if I understand how this is supposed to go, the sequence that it's supposed to go, in terms of the issue of atrazine only. There are certainly other places, other pesticides we'd need it. But if I understand correctly, there's supposed to be voluntary measures to, whenever we have something identified as a commonly detected contaminant, to remove it. And if after a period of time that's not effective, then it is removed from the market. And my understanding is it's been about 20 years, I think, of knowing that atrazine is a commonly detected contaminant. How long do we wait until it reaches that threshold that, I mean, that it then would be removed? I just don't understand why we're still even allowing it to be used in Minnesota if we're following what the 1989 Groundwater Protection Act requires. So tell me what I'm missing here.
Mr. Stutter. Mr. Chair, Representative, the Groundwater Protection Act does not necessarily mean non-degradation. Non-degradation is a formal goal of the Act, but it also says, and I forgot the exact term, but it's got to be practicable. You've got to be able to achieve non-degradation.
Mr. Chairman, could I have a translation of that?
It makes sense.
Mr. Chair, the Groundwater Protection Act doesn't say that it has to be zero, that you can get non-degradation, that it can go down to zero. It can clean up the groundwater completely. It says, and again, I don't have it, the language in front of me, but non-degradation is the goal. But there is a qualifier if it can be practicably achieved.
Well, Mr. Chairman, but it seems like the testimony we heard is that it's still at a level that's hazardous to human health. So why would we be
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the big issue here is what are the appropriate standards? Dr. Hayes has talked about 1/10 of a part per billion, but until recently, the standard for atrazine in groundwater was 20 parts per billion, and now it's gone down to 3. What we find in our monitoring is that it's unusual to have 1 part per billion. And when you do, usually it's in an area that's very vulnerable. I shouldn't say it's unusual. It's very unusual to exceed a drinking water standard, including the 3 parts per billion. And usually where you do find elevated levels, they are in vulnerable aquifers. They're not in deeper aquifers.
So, Mr. Chairman, is the department going to consider the testimony that the level that we have in our state right now? And I can tell you that we had a discussion about this in our House of Representatives Public Health Committee, and we were not happy with ending up where we did. We wanted it to be much more protective. Can you tell me, is there going to be any consideration within the department for this kind of evidence that we had here today, or do we just continue to ignore it and say, well, we've had this standard and...
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, we're not ignoring it at all. One of the comments that I made is that the monitoring data from the Central Sand Plains, where we've had done continuous monitoring for many years, shows that the levels of atrazine are dropping. But in groundwater, you don't get rapid change. It takes time, but they are dropping. Having said that, in addition, we do not develop standards. Our agency does not have people who do that. And so we do count. Every year we forward our analytical lists for surface and groundwater to the PCA and Department of Health and request that they develop standards. And based on their available resources, they move forward on that. And we try to support them on that.
Mr. Chairman, my last comment. You may not develop the standards, but you sure do weigh in on them. Because in our committee in public health, we got lots of testimony influence, I'd say, from the Department of Agriculture on what the standard should be. In fact, a lot of pressure to make sure that bills that dealt with health issues went to the Ag Committee, where they were then bottled up and not, you know, really didn't go on. So, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll leave it at that. I guess I just want to thank you for this hearing. I think it's really important for us to, no matter which part of the process we're involved in, which of the committees we're involved in, I think it's really important that we're working together between the House and the Senate and trying to really get to the bottom of this.
Thank you. Representative Shumper, Mr. Watzko, did you want to comment?
I just want to make one quick comment concerning the senator's question and Mr. Stoddard's comment. He was talking about a certain group of wells in the Central Sands. Atrazine data from southeastern Minnesota is not collected in wells. It is collected in springs. And there is really no indication that the concentration of atrazine in that groundwater system is decreasing. So there are certain parts of the state where there clearly is not a decreasing amount of atrazine in what is being monitored for groundwater. And again, we're not sampling drinking water wells in southeastern Minnesota, so we just don't know what people are drinking. And that is really a critical thing to remember. We do not know what people in southeastern Minnesota are drinking, and again, that is the most vulnerable part of the state for this type of contamination. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Representative Chumper.
And just my final comment, that's why my earlier comment about the requirement in the 1989 Groundwater Protection Act of having these health risk limits reviewed every 4 years, and the fact that they haven't been since they were initially generated in 93 and 94 is so important here. I mean, I think most of us, and the legislation we passed this year requires using current scientific research. I think most of us understand that scientific research has really jumped ahead in the last 14 or so years, and we're going to see downward pressure on these numbers for health risk limits. And had that been done earlier, we, in fact, would perhaps be seeing all kinds of violations of the health risk limits by the concentrations of atrazine that are being detected all over the state. So, you know, it's kind of like there's no problem because we're not really looking for a problem because we don't really have the standards that will identify a problem because we haven't enforced the 1989 Groundwater Protection Act. So,
Mr. Chair, if, perhaps we could move this whole issue along a little bit, Representative Shumper. If you and I got together and trucked up some water from our wells in aquifer in southeastern Minnesota to provide drinking water to the capital, may move some legislation along a little bit.
Yes, that would have an impact.
In
Senator
one way,
Higgins.
In one way or another, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stoddard, you said that some of the higher levels of atrazine that you see are in the vulnerable aquifers. Did I understand that correctly?
Yes.
Does the department have a policy or has even thought about the idea that in those vulnerable aquifers, possibly it shouldn't be a voluntary standard? It should be a higher standard because of the vulnerability of, say, the karst region or, you know, some of the other areas. And if not, why not?
Senator, the best management practices for atrazine do address higher risk areas. They have a lower atrazine application rate in coarse textured soils than in southeast Minnesota. So we do have more restrictive voluntary BMPs in those areas.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Stoddard, but if they're voluntary, do you have any sense of whether people are following those standards?
Mr. Chair, Senator, again, in the Central Sand Plains, we do see that the standards are dropping. And I,
Mr. Stoddard, where are the Central Sand Plains?
Standards. In central Minnesota, there are outwash sands that cover six or seven different counties, or I forget the exact number, around the St. Cloud area and north the Otter Tail. And those counties, we have a dedicated monitoring well network, which is essentially an early warning system. It monitors on the edge of fields. And we've been monitoring there since the early 90s.
So Mr. Stoddard, is that considered a vulnerable aquifer, Central Sands area?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, it is, very definitely. Hmm. Coarse textured soils are very vulnerable, and in southeast Minnesota where you have karst terrain, that's also very vulnerable.
Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you. I live in that area in the test wells. The closest one I know of, it isn't there right now anymore, I don't think, because of a housing development, but it was about a quarter of a mile from my home.
Okay.
I had one final question, one or two final questions about the legislation I mentioned earlier. Does the department, I'm making an assumption here, but does the Department of Agriculture have any ability to measure health risks?
Mr. Chair, Senator, what we do is we monitor the groundwater and surface water, and then we provide the data and compare the data to standards that are developed by other agencies.
And a follow-up question then is, does the department have any position on having the health department be required to measure the health risks of certain pesticides?
Mr. Chair, Senator, by measure the health risk, I'm not sure what you mean.
In terms of having the Commissioner of Health have a say in any restrictions put on pesticides if there is scientific evidence of increased risk to public safety and health, and then weighing that against any benefits from the pesticide use and alternatives and so on. I was just curious if the department, this legislation would give the Commissioner of Health the requirement that for certain pesticides that they would have to weigh the health risk and would have a say in the use of the pesticide based on that.
Mr. Chair, my name is Quinn Cheney. I'm the legislative director at the Department of Agriculture. And while we have reviewed your legislation, we have not had a chance to fully vet it and discuss it and all the effects of it. And we'd like to do that both within the agency as well as with the Department of Health. So at a later date when we're in January, February, we'd be happy to do that.
Senator, if I could add one thing, though, we do talk regularly with the Department of Health. We do compare notes. We ask for their assistance on reviews. We are moving forward. The audit recommended that we come up with a special registration review process. We are doing that and in consultation with the Department of Health and Pollution Control Agency. So there's a lot of communication and feedback that occurs.
Thank you very much. And with that, if there are no further questions or discussion, I want to thank the witnesses for coming. I'll say particularly Mr. Watzka because he's gone through a lot to get here. So with that, this committee is adjourned. Thank you.